This is the Greenlian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Greenlian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Greenlian bunker, it's Micah Hanks and the Greenlian gang. Welcome everyone to another week of wildness and weirdness from our dark little corner of the web. I'm so glad as always to be here with you. Joining me in studio is the producer extraordinaire, the man who's been doing more show prep than most people in radio could afford to do in a week. And he probably did most of it just today. That's just how good he is. Chris Hayes, our producer extraordinaire and co-host of the program. How are you tonight, Chris?
I'm pretty good, but, you know, just text me whenever you...
Would you please just turn that microphone up?
I can't turn it up any louder.
Oh, that's right, because I've got the controls.
That's right. Hand it back over to Mr. Kind Eyes himself, the Reverend Matt Oakley. Matt, how are you this evening? I hope you're doing very well.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Hanging in there like a hair in a biscuit. And joining me to my left flank here aboard the Starship Enterprise, that makes me Captain Crunk, right? We have one of our science advisors. Yes, indeed, Mr. Josh Buckner. Josh, how are you this evening?
I am upright and breathing and happy to be here.
Glad to have you aboard, Captain. Well, Lieutenant, whatever I guess we would call him, right? Lieutenant?
Lieutenant's fine.
Lieutenant's a fine rank for you.
He can be Lieutenant Commander Geordi LaForge.
There we go. Fantastic.
I want a visor.
Whatever the case, we're glad to have you aboard, advisor. And you, my friends out there in Radio Land, are about to hear some rather extraordinary and fantastic things. But first, I want to go ahead and direct your attention to our website, www.greylianreport.com. Now, I usually, early in the program, start telling you to go look and see what we've got up at the Greenlian Report. But if you haven't been there in the last couple of days, you know, I don't see why you haven't been there today at all, because you, of course, are supposed to visit the site every day. You never know when there's going to be something incredible that goes live there at GreenlianReport.com. And right now, folks, we've got some extraordinary stuff up over there right this moment. In fact, we have a new look that I want you to check out. If you go to the Greenlian Report, we have an entirely new banner that incorporates some very, very interesting stylistic elements. You'll see a custom Greenlian green rocket shipped on the right side of the page. Now, a lot of people have looked at the new design and they're really upset. And the reason that they're upset is because they say, "Where's the little Greenlian guy? Where's your mascot?" Well, he's not gone.
He's in the rocket.
He's piloting the rocket. Exactly. Now, our little guy, he's going to still make appearances from time to time. We're going to give him some much-needed time off. But I do like the new look. I hope you like it just as well. And speaking of colors, we've got this link right there at the top of the page. Was that a UFO filmed over Utah? That's the question. Now, of course, the video that's linked directly below it says, "Fake Utah UFO continues to baffle the mainstream media." But the video is pretty interesting nonetheless, because when you look at this video, you can see indeed that there's something pretty... I mean, it looks pretty good. I don't know that I would look at that and say, yeah, that's obviously a UFO. I'd say that, you know, it looks pretty good. Then again, I'm inherently fairly skeptical of these sorts of things. But in the video, and we've got that linked there at GreenlianReport.com, I'd advise checking it out, having a look, see what you think. We linked it at our page on Facebook, which I'm sure if you're listening, you've already liked us there on Facebook. If you haven't, go check us out. All you have to do is search for the Greenlian Report on Facebook and you'll find us. But I linked that. You know, Mr. Mobius, who's one of our field correspondents, said that anyone who seriously thought that that thing in the video was a UFO needs to have been at our UFO contests. What he's talking about are the infamous Speaking of Strange UFO Experiences that we used to do with Joshua Warren several years ago. Mobius says, "This looks like LEDs, and the first step is to compare a sighting to known human technology. Before you jump to conclusions and think that you're seeing aliens or something like that, compare it to known human technology," which, to their, you know, to their credit, some of the individuals who were involved in this investigation were actually doing that. They were proposing that it was a paraglider. But in fact, what was actually going, I believe, was, well, you'll just have to watch the video. We'll just say it was a young entrepreneur who was kind of trying to get a name for his business, and therefore he had attached a banner to, well, yeah, what certainly looked from a distance like a UFO. And Mr. Mobius said, "I wish that more people had shared in this UFO contest experience, because essentially they too would be able to have our incredible abilities of discernment with regard to unraveling the mysteries of things seen in our skies."
Well, maybe it's not just our economy that's in the toilet. Maybe it's the galactic economy. So now the Zeta 2 reticulans are having to pick up a second job at Domino's.
They're downscaling.
You know, trailing the "Eat at Domino's" banner.
Yeah, they're having to cut things back a little bit. Yeah, and they've downgraded from Empiricon powered crystals to, well, you know, LEDs. Hey, Earth based technology. They're going to be spending time around here, they're just trying to fit in. You know, they want to look more like us, right?
Are they also Mormons?
I couldn't speak to that effect, but I hear that they keep incredible genealogical history of you know, their past Zeta 2 reticulum, back Zeta 1 reticulum lineages. So,
oh, wow.
Salt
yeah.
Lake City.
This
is
going,
that where they're from?
This is no, well, you know, originally they may have been from Salt Lake City, but that would have been in a past epoch. You know, the kind of past epoch that, of course, I talk about in that new edition of the Exposed, Uncovered, and Declassified series, Lost Civilizations and Secrets of the Past. I got the special edition in the mail today. Where is that thing? Do we have that? Do we have that New Dawn?
The gold-plated one?
Where's the New Dawn magazine? You know, the new edition, the new special edition of New Dawn magazine just came out.
It's around here somewhere.
It's around the studio someplace. Somebody probably, one of the Hadels grabbed it and ran off with it.
Sorry, those little tots.
They're getting their own little collections
little
of things.
Tater tots.
My little tots, they just run amok.
I know it was around here someplace, but anyway, yeah, the new special edition of New Dawn magazine has an article that deals with a subject very similar to what I'm talking about in the new Lost Civilizations and Secrets of the Past anthology, and that's around here someplace. But anyway, if you want to check that out, it's on newsstands everywhere, and you can find out more about that. I believe it's newdawnmag.com. We'll make sure that link is correct here in just a moment. But that said, speaking of blue lights seen in the sky, this proposed UFO over Utah was by no means the only strange thing that was seen in the skies this week. In fact, Bournemouth residents, I'm sorry, is it Bournemouth or Bournemouth?
I think it's Bournemouth.
Bournemouth. See, I didn't get it right either way.
You've got to say it in that pretentious English. Bournemouth.
Bournemouth. I'll put on...
Bournemouth.
Yes, it's Bournemouth. Of course, yes. We'll discuss that and other things during this hour of the program. But anyway, would someone make me a cup of English tea?
You want a cuppa?
I would like
it. Did you want cream with that?
No. I think...
No, in England we use milk in our teas.
Oh, yes, indeed. You know, speaking of, and I just have to say, one of our listeners had referred to our recent interview with Nigel Kerner, who is an incredibly brilliant guy, but they referred to the interview as being slightly zany. I guess it was kind of funny. We were all kind of having fun, and there were three of us talking the entire time. You know, it wasn't just Nigel and I. We had Dr. John Biggerstaff joining us as well. I found what they had to say incredibly interesting. But yes, they both had some of the more, you know, characteristic and delightful sounding English accents, indeed. And so, but you know, I think that goes over well over the year. I love hearing that. And you know, I think that some people want to giggle and laugh, but you know, I hope that the importance of the issues they were addressing was not missed on account of that. But that said, Bournemouth, I still did it wrong.
Bournemouth.
A Bournemouth resident mystified by blue sphere shower. This was reported by BBC News just this week. And they were talking about how this is really strange. What looked like little blue marbles had fallen from the sky. The blue spheres are jelly-like, but they have no odor and they're not sticky. Nobody's really sure what these are. Steve Hornsby from Bournemouth. I'm just never going to get this. You know,
anytime
everybody...
it says Bournemouth, point at me. Bournemouth.
Yeah, it's like... So let's try that one more time. Steve Hornsby from
Bournemouth
said that 3-centimeter diameter, but you know, it's like once one hits you like that, it's just all downhill from that point. Anyway, they were small marble-like balls about 3 centimeters in diameter, and they came raining down late on Thursday afternoon during a hailstorm. He found about a dozen of these little balls in his garden, and he said, they're difficult to pick up. I had to get a spoon and flick them into a jam jar because apparently they have kind of, I guess, a slippery kind of texture to them. Now, officials said that the jelly-like substance was not meteorological. In other words, they don't have a natural explanation for this, and this isn't, you know, I'll tell you what it sounds like. They talk about these things, this so-called rot from the stars. You think that
Bournemouth
is difficult to say, but try saying the old Welsh expression for this kind of phenomenon, poudre ser, which means rot from the stars. Anybody familiar with that?
Go for it, Chris. Try it.
I believe we spoke about the rot from the stars or the poudre ser sometime in July or August, actually.
Yeah. Earlier this year, we did touch on that. That's what this reminds me of, which literally there was an old tradition in the Welsh tradition, I guess, and throughout parts of Europe that when a shooting star fell from the sky, that you could run out into a field, especially in the springtime, and you'd often find a little jelly-like substance lying out there in the field, okay? So that's where this tradition came from, and I think Sir John Suckling wrote a famous poem that described finding this so-called rot from the stars that would be lying in fields. Now, the conventional explanation for this kind of phenomenon is that you go out into these fields, and what you're actually finding are little different various kinds of fungus that grow in fields, especially with the arrival of warm weather. And when most people would be out stargazing, not, of course, in the colder weather months, they'd be more likely to go out in the warm months and be chasing around in fields after shooting stars that presumably struck the Earth. It was in searching for these presumed landing spots that people would apparently come across these little jellies, these little fungi, and think that they'd actually found the fallen star. And thus the tradition was born that this was actually some kind of substance that came from the sky. And then you have these experiences like what Mr. Hornsby of the infamous town of
Bournemouth
talks about. And so he's actually in the Dorset area, just to be specific here. But again, these are, they have a strange texture. They're difficult for him to grasp, but they're jelly-like. They look kind of like little marbles. And he said that as he's walking around in his garden, he found lots of these little blue spheres lying around. They were scattered all across the grass. He said they have an exterior shell with a softer inner portion, but they have no, you know, they have no odor. They aren't really sticky, he says, and they don't melt. Now, Mr. Hornsby said that he was keeping the balls in his fridge while he tried to find out what they actually were. Josie Pegg, an applied science research assistant at Bournemouth University. That one wasn't too bad.
Very good.
Okay, I'm getting there. Josie Pegg speculated that the apparently strange phenomena might be marine invertebrate. I can't talk tonight. I'm having one of those nights. invertebrate.
Marine invertebrate
Thank
eggs.
You. Marine invertebrate eggs. These have been... You know what my problem is? You know, I told you guys what happened earlier. Let's just back up for just a minute. The reason I'm having difficulties pronunciating tonight, pronouncing things... Okay, I'm driving down the road. I'm making a payment. I have an envelope in my hand. I lick the envelope so as to moisten the sticky surface and seal the envelope before it goes into a mailbox. Oh, you funny guy. They're going to be taking advantage of my inability to pronounce things this evening. Anyway, so I'm you know, licking the envelope before I seal it, and then the telephone rings, and it's a number I don't recognize, and I'm like, what in the heck? And the paper slips and cuts me right here across the lip. You remember that episode of Coast to Coast years ago where Art Bell got super glue on his lip? He super glued his lip together.
Why would he do that?
Yeah, well, he didn't mean to do it. What happened was he was trying to fix something there in his studio, and the super glue started to seal, and I think he got a little on his finger or something like that, and immediately he'd burned himself also. That's what it was. There was something involving a cigarette. But anyway, so the super glue was on his finger, and it went up to his lip, something like that, and he got super glue on his lip and tried to peel it off, and he was in mortal pain trying to do the program that night. Well, okay, I'm in a similar situation. Yes, I got a paper cut right across my lip while trying to seal an envelope earlier today. So after that little ordeal, I'm sitting there, my lips stinging, and I'm driving down the road, and I'm like, okay, and I missed that call, and I didn't recognize that number. Who was that? Who was it that actually called me there? People are going to think I'm kidding. People are going to think I'm lying. They're going to think I'm an out-and-out liar. I'll tell you when we...
Wait, do we have legal permission to use this name on the air?
I'm not going to use anybody's name, but I don't think there's a problem with telling, you know, who contacted me.
Okay.
They probably think it's Giorgio Tsoukalos, right? No. You know, we have heard something from Giorgio.
Tsoukalos.
It's my lip, man. Hey, okay, enough lip for the time being. We'll talk about that mysterious phone call I had when we get back as we continue to probe the mysteries of time and space here on the Graylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks. We'll be back right after this.
Ranger Station.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting in the forest.
Uh-huh.
1 second I'm having a smoke. Next thing I know, I'm face-to-face with Smokey Bear.
Wow.
And he told me it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
Did you know 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans?
I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous and you're not. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
high mountains of Appalachia. It's the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
Let's try this one more time. Invertebrate eggs. That's what they're thinking these things are. Ooh. That's not too bad with a, you know, with a cut lip like I have. Oh, well, cut lip or no, hey.
I think you meant marine invertebrate eggs.
Marine invertebrate eggs. Yeah, you're just trying to make me slip up now. No, it's getting better. At least, like I said, it's not super glue. Hey, you know, a little super glue on my lip might have actually helped this time. It would have at least sealed the wound. But it's not that bad. Can you see it, Chris? Is it really noticeable?
No, I can't. I can't see it at all.
It's not noticeable. Maybe see if
totally we're hundreds of miles below the surface of the earth.
It's kind
of
dark.
I can't really see anything.
Yeah. It's kind of dark down here. Yeah, but anyway, that's okay. Hey, I saw Astrid Stromberg is in the chat room tonight. The very lovely Astrid. Much love to you, my dear. Always glad to have you around. Wherever we are, of course, you know you're always welcome. You know what? Just got a message also from our friend and field correspondent from Chicago, Tom Cameron. I'll be in touch with you, Tom, if you're out there listening right now just as well, trying to find out when this message came in. Speaking of messages, good grief, I've been getting so many messages lately from people, and as I'm driving down the road with my sore lip, I get another phone call. And I kid you not, I think I could probably get away with just going ahead and reading the email here. Where did I actually receive this email? I got to try and find out where it is. Here it is. Okay. I won't give the individual's name, but she says she's the casting producer for the show known as America's Got Talent for NBC Network. And she says that she would like to try and get someone from my group to come on to the priority audition schedule for this weekend in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I thought, my goodness, of all people to hear from right now, because, you know, I just submitted a book proposal today. Scotty Roberts and I are planning this Paradigm Symposium, and I just got word that right now we've gotten confirmation from none other than the mighty Giorgio Tsoukalos.
Tsoukalos. Bournemouth.
I'm going to get it one of these days. Giorgio's on board. We've got George Norrie and the fine folks at Premiere Network who are also going to be involved in this thing. Very glad to hear about that. Philip Coppens is going to be speaking, and of course Philip Coppens will be our guest tonight during Hour 2. He was kind enough to join me live via Skype yesterday. We had to pre-record the interview because he is out west right now, as I understand it, filming for the new season of Ancient Aliens. So there. And he was kind enough to work us into his schedule. He'll be joining us during Hour 2 tonight on the program. You don't want to miss that. We'll be discussing his new book, The Ancient Alien Question, a new inquiry into the existence, evidence, and influence of ancient visitors. You know, and I think that, in my personal opinion, Philip Coppens is going to emerge as one of the preeminent researchers in this field. He's already on up there, but I think that he's going to be... I mean, look, his book here, Eric von Daniken, actually wrote the foreword to this book. Did I mention Eric von Daniken's going to be at the Paradigm Symposium also? I think I did.
Who?
Eric von Daniken, author of Chariots of the Gods. Yes, he's going to be joining us at Paradigm Symposium just as well. Now, I know people are probably getting so tired of hearing me always talk about Paradigm Symposium. And they're like, well, where can we see more? Well, there's plenty of places where you can see more. I'm going to go ahead and direct you to a couple right now. If you visit www.graylianreport.com and you're going to check out our new look and marvel over this fantastic artwork that, you know what, none other than our very talented friend Scotty Roberts actually procured this new logo, which, if you look at that rocket ship, the custom Graylian green rocket ship that we've got on the new logo there, that actually was designed by Scotty, and you'll see that elsewhere. If you go to intrepidmag.com, that's the Intrepid Starship, okay? That's the Intrepid rocket, boldly going, Intrepid Mag. Of course, I write for Intrepid Mag each month, and Scotty was kind enough to incorporate that into the logo. I thought, you know, with Paradigm Symposium, which is being sponsored by Intrepid Mag and the Graylian Report, I said it would be so cool if we could incorporate some of that into the artwork with the Graylian Report. And he says, oh, here, yeah, we'll work something out, and here you go. Man, is he ever talented, and I love it. We've got a custom Graylian green rocket ship. But that's not replacing the little guy. Don't worry, our Graylian, we wouldn't be the Graylian Report without the actual mascot. And he'll still be popping up from time to time. You'll be seeing him again, I can guarantee you of that. But that said, while you're there at the website, underneath that fantastic new banner that we've got, just look in the toolbar, okay? And you'll see right near the center, between Copyright Notice and Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, you'll see Paradigm Symposium, okay? All you gotta do is click that link, And it's going to take you to a page that right now we've got a flyer up there that's got the image, most of the people who are going to be involved in this event on there. I think Giorgio's image is kind of blurred out, but we were pending confirmation at that point. So we've got the entire roster there. We've got the dates. We've got the location. We've got a little more information as well, and an official statement from Scotty Roberts there. But what's going to happen later this week is that's going to begin to link directly to, when you go to this page, there's going to be a link near the top of the page that will link you directly to the official website for the Paradigm Symposium, which we are launching this Friday, along with official ticket sales. Now, we're still firming up some contracts and things like that with some of the speakers, but we're certainly anticipating a fantastic event. We're also anticipating a very large turnout and a quick ticket sale, so you want to try and get in there Friday and take a look at this. I can go ahead and tell you what the website address is. It's pretty easy to imagine. It's paradigmsymposium.com. And so if you visit paradigmsymposium.com, you'll be able to... Right now, there's just kind of a placeholder for the time being. But, again, this Friday, you're going to be able to visit that, and there will be the official Paradigm Symposium website, which will be live. You're going to want to go ahead and sign up and get your tickets very soon, because, like I said, this is going to be a well-attended event. And we are so stoked about this. I don't get very excited anymore. You know, when you've got America's Got Talent calling you, you've got phone calls from producers and from different people like that. Oh, Mr. Big Britches, Mr. Micah Hanks, Mr. Big Britches, the mouth of the South. Yeah, whatever. No, I'm not like that. If you ever come and meet me, I'm a very humble person. I'll sit down and I'll have a cuppa with anybody. Won't I, Chris? I'm a nice guy.
You'll have cuppa with anybody.
I'm a gentleman.
Sometime, you actually made me cuppa the other day.
I made you a cuppa? Wait, would you just say cuppa what?
Cuppa.
Cuppa? You don't say a cup of... well, I guess it would be...
A cup of tea? No, that's way too hard to say.
I made you cuppa.
You just have to say cuppa.
I made you cuppa.
Would you like a cuppa, Governor?
I'd love a cuppa.
I have something to say.
What? Uh-oh. No, yeah, our science correspondent speaks! Hi, Josh.
Yeah, I think Matt has something to say. He looks very anxious over here.
I was just wondering why you're getting all this fame, Micah, and I'm still sleeping on the couch down in the damn studio.
Well, because I am the mover and the shaker here. I'm busting tail. You know, I hammered out about 4,000 words yesterday. I'll tell you, I got an extremely good compliment from one of my friends in the blogging community, Red Pill Junkie of DailyGrail.com. He called me the second, this is a while back, it was something to this effect, RPJ, you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but he says, next to Nick Redfern, he says, you might be the only true workaholic para junkie out there, which I take, I take that as a compliment. And I'll tell you what, Redfern's another guy who, he's busting his buns on a daily basis, trying to make it doing this stuff. And that's the way you've got to be. I mean, the economy's not great, but you know what? I believe that opportunities are out there. You make them. You don't wait for them to come to you. And I'm making opportunities, and I sincerely hope that this opportunity, Paradigm Symposium, is something we can all enjoy and be a part of. So indeed, look into getting your tickets right away. It's very reasonably priced compared with a lot of these other experiences that are going out there, and you'll get to meet me. We're going to be doing a live broadcast of the Grailian Report from the convention center there. It's actually the DoubleTree Hotel there in downtown Minneapolis that we're going to be doing that. That's where we're holding the convention. But we're going to be doing a live broadcast of the Grailian Report. There's going to be a banquet with a panel discussion that Ian Punnett, also of Coast to Coast AM, will be moderating. Scotty and I will be the presenters, and we'll be kind of emceeing the event. But we'll also be talking about our new books that will be coming out by one of our fantastic sponsors for this event, New Page Books. They'll be our publishers, and they're already our publishers. In fact, they were the publishers of all these exposed, uncovered, and declassified books that we've been talking about for quite some time. So, yeah, long story short, you don't want to miss this one. And, yes, there will probably be hors d'oeuvres served along the lines of marine invertebrate eggs that have been laying in a field for a few days.
Well, Micah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to cut you off there and... I'm going to have to rain on your parade with those marine invertebrate eggs.
Okay.
Yes, because our science correspondent, Joshua Buckner, has sent me a story.
A story?
Yes, a story from today.
Can I read that headline, please?
Yes, please do.
Yes, of course.
Blue Balls mystery close to being solved.
Thank God, finally.
We've all been waiting on this one, fellas.
All right, so no more blue balls. What's happened is...
To all the gentlemen out there in the listening audience, pay attention.
These blue orbs, or balls, as they're being referred to now, have been actually sent to a university in England. Let me see which Bournemouth University, and it turns out through some of the testing they've done that they have ruled out any living tissue. It's not living material at all, so it's not fish eggs. One of the scientists said that the balls look very much like the florist's hydrating jelly, as suggested by some eagle-eyed members of the public.
Huh, that's interesting. You know, and actually, during the break, Josh, you had been saying that, you know, just from looking, just kind of eyeballing those objects in the video, what we didn't do, we didn't appear to...
Stop touching your microphone!
Yeah.
Complicated.
Yeah, it's complicated. Is that your Facebook status, Josh? He's got a complicated microphone over there. Yeah, I'll tell you, our engineer will help him with his microphone. But in the meantime, I do want to say on his behalf that he was looking at the images on the the BBC link that we had there? Yeah, no, it was a BBC News link there. We had the Bibka News link there, and it didn't appear to be something that was biological, even in those photos, did it?
No, absolutely not. There was nothing inside of the shell or the egg, or where there should have been something growing. Mm-hmm. And they're split in half, and it doesn't look like, usually like a marine egg of some sort has a gelatinous substance mm-hmm. inside. And if you break the shell, it kind of collapses, and it appeared to stay somewhat rigid on the outside, so it didn't really look
well. See,
eggy.
Now the question I have is, why are aliens throwing florist's hydrating gel at these poor people in Bournemouth?
It depends on the quality of the grass.
Say it right, Chris. Say it right.
Bournemouth.
This could get potentially very dangerous. This could get very, very frightening. Who knows? Are aliens trying to inseminate our oceans?
Pretty soon they're going to be throwing orchids and false pansies
baby's
everywhere.
Breath.
There's going to be baby's breath. Yes, exactly. And florist foam. You know how hard that is to wash off if you've ever used it.
Yeah. Like I said, this could get nasty. It'll get worse before it gets better. And, of course, we'll keep our finger on the pulse, so to speak, so that we can see where this one goes. No, actually, in all truth, it's probably nothing ominous. This kind of thing has happened a number of times in the past. And, in fact, I remember Jerry Clark had a fantastic entry on this in one of those great big paranormal 4TN anthology kind of things that they put out years ago. I think it was, I can't remember, it was an Encyclopedia of the Paranormal, something like that. And I think it was republished under different titles over the years, so... You know, but some of you people out there who are collectors of Fortiana and specifically books dealing with this subject matter, you'll know already what I'm talking about. Anyway, that's where I first read about the Poudre Cere, you know, this Welsh rot of the stars. And there have been things like this that have occurred on a number of instances. I think in Texas, you know, several decades ago, there were little purple gelatinous blobs that were found all over people's front yards. But they were all also within just a few... maybe within like a mile radius of some sort of a power plant there in the area, and some people thought that there was some sort of a manufactured substance that could have been a byproduct of some sort of exhaust or something like that rising from the smokestacks at this chemical plant or something like that. So, you know, there have been a lot of different theories about these sorts of things, and it's, you know, natural that we want to try and gravitate toward, well, a natural explanation. So the marine invertebrate egg hypothesis might have been as good as any until, of course, we see these things. And clearly, they do look like those little decorative little ornamental marbles that you'd like at a dollar store or something.
It kind of actually looks just like a blob of hair gel, like really cheap hair gel, like Dippity Doo. Mm-hmm. I used to use that in high school.
You remember the old song, Mountain Dew? You know, see, I play in a bluegrass band, so I know all these songs. Well, they call it that good old Mountain Dew. Ladies and gentlemen, Micah Hanks sings all your favorite hits. That's what I'm going to go do. It's not Dancing with the Stars. What is it? America's Got Talent. I'm going to be on Dancing with the Stars, everyone!
I would much prefer to see you on Dancing with the Stars.
I think most of the listenership would much prefer to see me on Dancing with the Stars. Yeah, I'm out there. I'm not a good dancer. Let me just go ahead and tell you.
You're not a good dancer?
I'm not a good dancer. I might be able to talk, you know.
We don't need indefinite articles here.
Not good dancer, number one doctor in Ukraine, though.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I've got a lot of things going on. As a matter of fact, ladies, I would recommend having me as a doctor, you know, and participating in a surgery rather than having me as a dancing partner, because I...
because when Micah plays doctor, he plays to win.
Oh, boy. You know, anyways, I should have known it was going to go in that direction. But anywho, well, that said, I thought that was a pretty interesting case. We will indeed follow that one. Oh, I know what it is. No, what it is somebody spilled a bottle of their hair gel down the toilet in an airplane, and then this stuff went... out the chute and into the air, and now it's all over the ground. They're going to do like a, you know, chemical analysis and be like, well, yeah, this is dippity doo. But that's why I brought up. That's why I brought the old.
Came out of the airplane toilet. It's dippity doo doo.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right. The doos multiply when it goes through the poop chute. So, anyway, but the old song. yeah, the old song Mountain Dew. I'm sorry, our producer's having a conniption fit now. The old song Mountain Dew actually says, there's a line in there that says something to the extent of, he wears no dippity doo. That's where that came from. That's why that came to mind.
But he does. Well, he did.
Did he wear dippity doo?
I did wear dippity doo.
You wore dippity doo.
But back then, I could spike my hair up so hard, I could stab your eyeballs out with the spikes of my hair.
I'll tell you what, Josh, our science correspondent here, actually, I like calling him the science officer, since, you know, I feel like with the orientation we have here in the studio right now, we feel like we're piloting a starship. You know, I'm Captain Crunk, and then we've got Matt. What do you do,
especially,
by the way? Oh, he's the engineer.
Well, and especially when the computer in front of you goes into the screensaver and it's just soaring through the,
yeah,
the stars.
I've still got that 1994, perfect. You know, you're flying through space screensaver. Yeah, that's really awesome. That's high tech. That's high tech.
Well,
Josh, what I was going to ask you, though, buddy, is do you use dippity-doo on that mighty beard of yours?
No, I like to keep it natural. I condition, and that's about it. I like to let it get Bigfooty.
That's a Sasquatch's. That beard, in fact, would actually probably make most Sasquatches I've ever seen quite envious.
Actually, I have a side job where I go out and pretend to be Sasquatch for people.
There you go.
It works for me.
Not for us, though. I mean, it would work for us, but, you know, he doesn't pretend for us.
His rates are real low, guys.
That's right.
It's like $10.
That's right. Oh, gosh.
It's gratifying work.
It is. It certainly is. Yeah. The birthday Sasquatch suit guy. Oh, man. Is that going to be a new business endeavor? Brought to you by the fine folks at Graylian International. The birthday Sasquatch suit guy. That's probably something like that. I think it's about time to go pay the bills. When we come back from this break, more strange news from beyond the fringe, as you can come to expect every week here on the program. And, of course, we'll be taking your insights. You can reach us via text message at any time, 828-367-7201. And, of course, the phone lines are open, as well as our Skype line, if you'd like to contact us that way. Share your own thoughts, and we'll hope to hear from you after this on the Graylian Report. Micah Hanks of the Graylian Report here. I just wanted to take a minute, well, really just 30 seconds, to tell you a little about a wonderful project I'm privileged to be a part of these days. It's called Intrepid Magazine. Intrepid is an eclectic melting pot of a variety of different areas of interest, ranging from politics and fringe science to mysteries of the unexplained. You'll hear from authors like Nick Redfern, April Slaughter, Marie D. Jones, and Larry Flaxman, editor and publisher Scotty Roberts, and, of course, yours truly. It's Intrepid Magazine, boldly going. Period. Subscribe today. Visit www.intrepidmag.com.
Mountains of Appalachia. It's the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
Welcome back to the program. It is the Graylian Report, and I'm, of course, your host, Micah Hanks, keeping you company every Tuesday evening from 8 to 11 Eastern Time. Tonight, keeping us company during Hour 2, we're going to be talking with Philip Coppens, author of The Ancient Alien Question. He's one of the many stars of the program Ancient Aliens on History Channel. And, of course, we're going to be discussing not only ancient aliens. You know, Phil's got a lot of different projects he's involved with these days. He's going to be talking about an e-book he's got coming out very soon called Killing Kennedy. Now, as I understand it, this book was actually written a few decades ago, but he's recently made this available as an e-book. And I think that he kind of got his introduction to a lot of the strange and the unusual, starting off with his interest in conspiracy theories and, of course, the Kennedy assassination and different things like that. So we'll be interested in hearing more from Philip Coppens during the second hour of tonight's broadcast. Who actually, it is a pre-recorded interview. He's filming right now in on the West Coast for the fourth season of Ancient Aliens. I believe it's season number four.
Season 4, which should premiere on H2, formerly History International, February 17th.
Fantastic. This guy's on top of it. Producer Chris Hayes, ladies and gentlemen. That said, if you'd like to jump in and share your own thoughts for the time being, we are going to leave the phone lines open for the remainder of this hour. We'll come back and do open lines during the third hour, which is funny because every time I go on the air and I actually say it's going to be open lines with Micah Hanks, it's phone call after phone call, you know. But then when it's the Grayling Report, I think that people know that the mouth of the South has a lot to say, and they're more timid about getting in on the conversation. It's like, how do you get a word in edgewise with that guy? In fact, you know, I might as well just go ahead and point this out. I was browsing the forums for the popular paranormal podcast, The Paracast, probably, arguably, one of the very finest. I mean, you know, they call themselves the gold standard of paranormal radio, and I would have to agree that that probably is a very fitting title for them. They indeed are some of the very best out there. Well, anyway, that said, I was browsing the Paracast forums, and I saw some comments on a thread titled Micah, you know, the Micah Hanks Show. They weren't talking about this program. They were talking about an edition of the Paracast that I went on and appeared as a guest. And one of these comments was, I'll read it to you. It went like this. Man, the guy can definitely talk. They're talking about me. The guy can definitely talk. But everything he said makes sense and was interesting. The show confirms my general impression that journalist researchers make the best guests. Hanks doesn't have a personal axe to grind or a special message from E.T. or some secret knowledge about the end of the world, but he can talk about all these sorts of things in an interesting and knowledgeable way. And, well, many kudos, huh? That was a fantastic compliment, in my opinion. And yes, that's why they call me the mouth of the South.
Well, that's almost as nice as that other comment we got on our Facebook page. What was it? It said, the mouth is going down south?
The comment, the comment Chris is talking about, I think I've actually got it right here. It says, dirty mouth going south.
Oh, yeah, that's weird.
Dirty mouth going south.
But really nice.
I mean, I guess they're acknowledging the mouth of the South, of course.
It's not our kind of program, really. That's not really the content we provide. But
one of the listeners a while back had actually asked me, he said, did a girl give you that nickname? And I said, it was terrible because the setup was perfect. I said, well, yeah, my mom started calling me that. Oh, my mother. But the thing is she used to always say when I was a kid, boy, you never shut up. You should go work in radio because you never shut up. And, well, hey, look, here we are. That worked out pretty well, didn't it? But anyway, so that said. And then funny thing is actually then I noticed that Chris O'Brien commented on that post. I put that up on my Facebook page. And Chris O'Brien, co-host of the Paracast, jumped on there and he says, let's get you back on the Paracast soon. So they're hoping to try and do that sometime this month. And you can look out to hear more about that. Maybe we'll get Chris back on this program. You know, I interviewed Chris many years ago and I always love talking with Chris O'Brien. He's one of the best. He and Gene Steinberg are both two of the best guys out there in the field. You know, they don't ask easy questions. I, as a researcher who prides myself in what I do, I appreciate that. And I also like talking with them. Because I think that they are people who are skeptically minded. But again, they're not debunkers. They're careful with the questions that they ask, and they want to get to the bottom of things. And they're really out there looking for truth and not just to kind of, you know, to pass the time away. And in fact, speaking of which, when we talk with Philip Coppens during the next hour, you know, there's been a lot of kind of debate going on. I've gotten a lot of emails from listeners and people who in the past have heard me talking about the subject of Vimanas. Vimanas, of course, refer to flying aircraft that were presumed to exist in ancient times. They were referred to specifically in ancient Vedic texts like the Mahabharata and the Ramayana and the Bhagavad Gita and things like that. But anyway, Vimanas, I have made the assertion in the past, while I think it's clear, let me put it to you like this. While I think it's clear that the Vedas talk about there being flying objects, which they've referred to as Vimanas, the important thing to remember about Vimanas is that Vimana was a word that also referenced a lot of other kinds of things, palaces or temples. Sometimes it meant literally chariots of the gods, which of course was the famous title of Eric von Daniken's book. It also meant sometimes different kinds of medicinal things as well. So Vimana was used to mean a lot of different things in the Sanskrit documents. And having spoken with a lot of linguists and people like that who are experts in the Sanskrit language, they say that you have to be kind of careful because the interpretation of what a Vimana was or how it was supposed to be acting or behaving, that is something that, you know, in many instances, due to the multiple uses of that word, Vimana, in different contexts, you have to look for contextual clues to understand what a Vimana was actually meant to be in various parts of these Vedic texts. Now, that said, I've pointed out that, you know, some of these documents, like the Vimanika Shastra, which was authored in 1920, well, it was kind of a channeled document. In fact, it wasn't just kind of, it certainly was channeled. And that document purported to relay information about the mechanical workings of these alleged Vimana craft. Well, unfortunately, the problem with that is that, without there being any kind of firm basis for where that information came from, it becomes difficult to take a document written in the 20th century, channeled by an individual which allegedly pertains to flying craft that must have existed thousands, maybe 3,000 or more years ago, and try and make a distinct parallel and a strong case from that parallel with regard to technological, machines, intelligently designed craft flying around, UFOs, if you will, in ancient India. Okay, so that said, I've, gotten a lot of people who, some of them have been angry about it, and some of them have been more careful and just wanting clarification, but they've said, there are researchers out there who are very well-known and well-regarded, like Phil Coppens, who say that there is a justification for Vimanas in the Vedas. So, I don't see why you say one thing, and some of these really well-researched individuals are saying other things. So during the interview with Phil Coppens, I addressed that, and I'll tell you this, I don't think that Philip Coppens and I disagree at all. It really comes down more to semantics in terms of what we're dealing with regard to the Vimana mystery. But you don't want to miss his take on all that. Not just that, but he talks about, we get into this discussion of UFOs, we talk a little bit about Kennedy, we talk, of course, about his new book, The Ancient Alien Question, geopolymers. Anybody know about geopolymers? Understand what those are? This is a fantastic theory. It's actually been around for a number of years, and although I was familiar with the idea, Phil articulates it so well, and this is a literal potential for how the ancient pyramids might have actually been built. Chemical and sampling tests that were done of actual pyramid material, the stone from which the pyramids were built, does strongly suggest that a process known as the creation of geopolymers may have something to do with how those massive temples were built in ancient times. Now the question is, how does such a unique process come into the knowledge of people in ancient times? Something that even today many are entirely unaware of in terms of engineering and architecture. It's a very interesting and compelling case that Mr. Coppens makes. We'll finish up this hour right after this break, and then we'll be talking with Philip Coppens here on the Grayling Report. I'll tell you again, you don't want to miss that. And he will be at the Paradigm Symposium with us later in October of this year. For the time being, we're going to go ahead and pay the bills. I'm Micah Hanks. It's the Grayling Report. Stay tuned, and we'll be back right after this. For most of us, chocolate is a guilty pleasure. Come on, admit it. You've got a sweet tooth just like the rest of us. But if I told you that eating chocolate was actually really good for your health and happiness, you'd probably say I was in La La Land. Hey, I wouldn't argue. Here's why. Every batch of the fine handcrafted chocolates at La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate is made from scratch, using organic, fair trade, and 100% natural ingredients. From the first bite, you'll know you're enjoying true quality, and the heart shape isn't the only way you'll feel the love. In fact, every chocolate from La La Land Organics is made by Melody Dawn Germain herself, and according to her own special recipe. You'll be enjoying Ecuadorian heirloom cacao in every bite, along with a selection of wholesome herbs and superfood supplements that not only make La La Land Organics delicious, but really good for your health and happiness. They're all natural, gluten-free, and no dairy, soy, or refined sugars are included, which help them boost your energy, reduce stress, and promote longevity. And as if healthy organic chocolates didn't remove the guilt factor enough, Melody ships all her orders in reusable, food-grade, non-BPA containers designed to eliminate toxic residue and cut down on environmental waste. Be sure and visit Melody's website at www.mdgnewmedia.com. That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Just click chocolate in the toolbar at the top of the page. You can't miss it. And while you're there, you can see a full list of the ingredients that will be sure to put a smile on your face. And I promise, it's guilt-free. La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate. Why wait? That website again is mdgnewmedia.com.
mountains of Appalachia. It's the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
From the dark heart of the Appalachian Mountains to all our friends around the globe on the internet tuning into the program tonight, welcome to the Graylian Report. Finishing up this segment before we get into our interview with Philip Coppins tonight discussing ancient aliens. This is a subject that's on everybody's mind, and of course that will be part of the focus this year at the Paradigm Symposium. But, you know, I'm going to be kind of taking it in the opposite direction. I think that in order to really understand our place here in the universe and to understand our place as a species here on terra firma, I think that we can't maintain solely a temporal kind of view of things. We can't be too caught here in the present. Now, it's healthy, of course, we all know, to live, to exist to the best of our ability in the present. You don't want to live in the past. That's not a healthy thing. You don't want to live with an expectation for the future that, if never realized, doesn't allow for you to grow in the present. You do need to be able to be comfortable with who you are now, be happy with the life that you have right now, and take the good with the bad as it comes, and to cope with the past and leave the past where it belongs. But that said, we can't learn entirely everything that we are intended to know about ourselves and our place in the universe, in this life, in the here and now, if we don't carefully examine the role that our past has played, and furthermore, the role that our future will continue to play in our lives and in our development, both as individuals and as a species, as we move forward together. That's why I think that it is very important to look at, you know, the theories of lost civilizations, you know, and ancient mysteries of the past, whether or not those involve paleo contact and contact with extraterrestrial entities or any other kind of non-human intelligence. You know, some of these things just involve different kinds of contact between existing human intelligences. I don't buy the old, the time-tested notion that, you know, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue and came to the United States. We know that that wasn't the first contact that the West had begun to have with other parts of the world. That was the most recent, widely known, and widely reported contact, but archaeological evidence shows us otherwise. And yet there are so many in the scientific intelligentsia, in the scientific community and in the archaeological communities, you know, of course that's a form of science as well, but the point is that there are people out there who are educated and who almost deliberately skirt these issues. They don't want to have to deal with the past. They don't want to have to look at what role humanity may have played in ancient times and what kind of contact different factions of humanity may have been having with one another. They didn't want to have to deal with that. They don't. Maybe it's that, as Ivan Sanderson said, these individuals don't want to have to be faced with the literal rewriting of history books. They're so protective of what they feel that they are experts of. They are so protective of these time-tested, tried-and-true, these notions that are really half-truths, if that. I remember going down in a cave in part of eastern Tennessee one time with one of our field correspondents, Christopher McCollum. He and I went, because this is something that I do quite a bit. If you look at the pictures of me on GraylianReport.com, you'll see pictures of me in a cave. No big surprise. I'm in a cave right now! But we went down in a cave. Appalachian Caverns was the name of this cave, and they showed us a spot on the wall where they said these look like, you know, some sort of Scandinavian runes of some kind, some sort of European. They weren't recognized as a known language, but these appeared to be runes, you know, of some sort, and they were in this cave in Tennessee, and they say we have no idea where they could have come from, how they may have gotten there. You know, you don't read about those kind of things often enough in history books. Why is that? But in addition to understanding the past, it has become of utmost importance to me to also look to the future, which is something you'll be hearing a lot more about from me in the coming months, especially with some of these book projects coming up. But for the time being, we're going to have to leave the future as it may come, and it will be here eventually. In the immediate future, we'll be talking about the past yet again with our guest, Philip Coppins, here on the Graylian Report, right after this. Stay tuned.
If your walls could talk, what would they say? I have sent children into fits of rage.
I am responsible for a child's speech impediment.
I am the reason a child can't read. Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Hey guys, Jamie Havoc in here for UFO Mag. Do you want to receive the best writing there is in ufology, the best writers, editors, and flat out the best magazine that ufology can offer? If so, I highly recommend UFO Magazine. You can check it out at ufomag.com. And if you mention that you heard this on radio, you can get 6 issues for $19.95. Check it out, ufomag.com. Don't miss out and keep up to date on the hottest topics in ufology. For UFO Mag, this is Jamie Havokin.
All right, guys, I know you've been putting it off. Your thirst for knowledge is incredible, insatiable, but your wallet says otherwise. So you haven't been able to subscribe to all those classy magazines out there bringing you to the edges of the fringe just like you and I do every week here on the Graylian Report. Well, good news for you. You can now subscribe to Intrepid Magazine for an entire year and just pay $19.95. Really? That's it? It's no joke. $19.95 will get you an entire year of incredible insight from authors like Nick Redfern, Scotty Roberts, and of course yours truly. It's Intrepid Magazine, boldly going. Visit www.intrepidmag.com today and feel your mind expanding tomorrow.
Want to have some fun? Maybe get a little bit of insight. Get a lay of the land. Want to know what's really going on? Do what I do. Listen to Future Theater. It airs every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, on the InceptionRadioNetwork.com. We'll see you there.
The 9/11 memorial is for the 343 firefighters who didn't make it.
For my husband, who died that day.
And the first responders who saved my life.
Because the best of humanity can overcome the worst hate.
This is Robert De Niro. This year, as we open the 9/11 Memorial in New York City, we ask that you join us to honor, remember, and reunite. To learn more or to reserve your visit, go to 911memorial.org.
Brought to you by the 9/11 Memorial and the Ad Council.
Theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And welcome back to the program. Micah Hanks here, and it is the Graylian Report, your weekly installment of the strange, the unusual, and this week a very special excursion into our ancient past. Mysteries that may involve intelligences that surpass humankind and our capabilities, at very least what we were capable of many, many years ago, perhaps centuries, if not thousands of years ago. And many are proponents of this idea today because of the popularity of programs like Ancient Aliens that we see on History Channel, the books of individuals like Eric Von Daniken, and of course our guest tonight, Philip Coppens. He is the author of the new book, The Ancient Alien Question. He's also a contributor to the Lost Civilizations and Secrets of the Past anthology released recently by New Page Books. The Ancient Alien Question lays out astonishing new proof that our ancestors were far more technologically advanced than we may realize, and maybe even that some of our early cultures here on planet Earth interacted with extraterrestrial non-human intelligence who shared scientific knowledge with them. I'm very intrigued by this. I have been for quite some time, and therefore I'll relish this opportunity to speak with the very mighty Philip Coffins with us tonight on the Grayling Report. Welcome to the program, Philip.
Thanks for having me.
So glad to have you here. And of course, there's so much to discuss, and as usually is the case, so little time. So we'll jump right into it. And for those who, I have a hard time imagining anyone not familiar with your work already. Of course, you are well known from the popular History Channel program Ancient Aliens. And of course, you're also very multifaceted in your research. We're going to talk about everything tonight from ancient aliens to the Kennedy assassination. But for those who may not be familiar with your work, why don't we introduce you now to the listenership and have us, hear a little bit about you and what you do and how you got into the study of ancient archaeology and extraterrestrials.
Well, by either by divine guidance or sheer coincidence, if there's a distinction between those two, I was an investigative journalist. I was and still am interested in the way basically people behind the scenes, not so much the what people would call the Illuminati or anything like that, are controlling politics, but very much how, what we get into the media is a distillation of a much more complex scenario, much more varied interests which are pushing these things through. And specifically in the early 1990s, this had to do, or I was focusing rather my interests on the Kennedy assassination, so much so because JFK, the movie by Oliver Stone, was being prepared. The Iron Curtain had fallen, and an awful lot of information was coming out from behind the former Iron Curtain, specifically Russia, to do with the fact that Kennedy's alleged assassin, Oswald, had spent time in the Soviet Union. They obviously had an entire intelligence apparatus as a KGB to look into whom the Russians felt were behind the Kennedy assassination, and all of that stuff, basically, I was interested in the early 1990s. And then a guy called Bill Cooper made this gigantic claim in a book, Behold a Pale Horse, mm-hmm. which basically said that Kennedy was killed for about to be revealing information to do with UFOs. And I'd heard about UFOs, obviously. I'd seen things like E.T., Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and all of that stuff. But it wasn't any of my primary interests. So I began to read up. I tried to find what I could. And remember, these are all days before the internet, so it meant dashing to books. And there was books about Billy Meyer, about spaceships of the Pleiadians, where he had encounters with. And there were books from Eric von Däniken.
Oh,
and
yes.
So I read basically what I could read. Didn't really go that far initially, because what was happening at that moment in time was that the statements which Cooper were making were quite ridiculous. For example, he said that Kennedy had been shot by his driver, and this is really something which is impossible.
Right.
So I kind of like filed it, somewhere, and then a publisher wanted me to come and work for them, and specifically to promote two books. One of them had to do with a discovery found in the Mystery of Rennell Chateau, probably famous for the Da Vinci Code right now. And the other one had to do with the megalithic civilization, which is precisely the article which has gone into the anthology of lost civilizations. And basically, in trying to find out more and how to promote these things, I crossed paths with a very dear friend of Eric von Däniken called Udo Lopatka. And from one thing came to another, I ended up speaking at Eric's conference in 95, 97, and 99. Became friends with him and various other people involved. And it made me realize that what was happening from like about 94 onwards really was that there is an awful lot of information which the alternative field has, but that they have big problems in making this open or available or digestible to a larger audience. Sometimes the theories are very specific, very bespoke, and go into such extraordinary detail that you can't see some of the bigger extrapolations which are being made from this research. And basically what I wanted to do was make sure that whenever I was writing for a larger audience, actually the people involved were able to comprehend what really was at the source of this. So, it's taken various forms, and obviously at the same time I've had ideas of my own which I have put out there. But basically I consider myself to be an investigative journalist who basically tries to bring material from the esoteric field whenever there is something noteworthy to do there to a larger audience.
And that's something I like about you, Philip. You know, with your research, I've looked into a lot of the ancient mysteries myself. In fact, you know, you and I actually appeared in this Lost Civilizations and Secrets of the Past anthology together. When I talked about ancient nuclear weapons, you know, I, in fact, in part of my research, looked at your own research into that kind of thing. And the truth of the matter is that while I don't think we can deny that there are nuclear events, whether natural or man-made, that occurred in ancient times, you know, you're a researcher who has examined that subject, but you are careful in terms of committing to the idea that maybe ancients actually harnessed nuclear devices and things like that. You are truly a great researcher in that regard, and that's something I respect about you. I would love nothing more than to see, especially your fame from your books and from History Channel and Ancient Aliens, you know, to kind of propel you into the limelight more so, because I feel that we need people who are reasonable and who are rational about their approaches to things, you know, and as opposed to just going straight for the, you know, for this most sensational thing, you'll incorporate that when it fits into a larger scope, so to speak. And I certainly see you doing that with the ancient alien question. That is so fantastic. So, And that said, my next question, with regard to ancient aliens, I remember a conversation I had with an astronomer years ago. We were discussing the potential for UFOs and extraterrestrial visitation to Earth today. And the individual said, "I don't believe that we are being visited. There's no proof of that. This is a typical skeptical argument. I think that there's plenty of evidence for UFOs, but sure, I agree. There may not be direct scientific proof of extraterrestrial visitation. We can't rule it out as a possibility." But then he said a very strange thing, Phil. He said, "But I don't think that it's impossible, and in fact, it's probably likely that at some point in our past, maybe paleo contact occurred. We were visited in ancient times, and ancient humans were probably influenced by extraterrestrial advanced technology." What are your feelings with regard to that, and what kind of evidence is there for that sort of paleo contact?
Well, it's an interesting thing that, you know, the astronomer didn't want it to be within his own field, but instead kind of like pile it onto somebody else's problem.
Right.
And I quite often find that is the case. They are open to it to some extent sometimes, as long as it doesn't impact themselves directly. You know, obviously, the ancient alien question is kind of like, I'd say there's a reason why the book is called The Ancient Alien Question rather than The Ancient Alien Answer.
Right.
And to some extent, that is to do with the fact that we live in an age where science is completely averse to incorporating anything, which involves ancient aliens. Now, when it comes to whether or not our ancestors have been contacted, the statistical things are this. We have direct evidence from various cultures. For example, ancient Egypt, which says in the shape of the high priest of Heliopolis called Manetho, that his people were absolutely convinced that there was a reign of the gods, which roughly lasted from 27,000 BC up until about 7,000 BC. That for this period of time, the gods ruled directly over the land of Egypt. We have stories from the Hopi who say that at one point in the past, the gods were physically present there. We have evidence from, for example, Peru, which says that there was a civilizing deity called Viracocha who appeared, passed on secrets of civilization. We have stories from the Middle East, specifically a priest, Berossus, who says that the Babylonians were contacted by a series of seven half-fish, half-humankind creatures, the first of which was called Oannes, mm-hmm. and brought civilization to mankind. All of our ancient, not all, but the vast majority of our ancient civilizations, and specifically the bigger ones, all say that this path of civilization was not walked by us ourselves, but that we had help, specifically by gods, and that these gods were once present, sometimes physically present amongst them. And so, you know, this scientific thing that somehow the ancient alien theory is really a disservice to our ancestors, in my opinion, is a gigantic lying smokescreen, because our ancestors say they were not alone. And so if we want to pay any respect to our ancestors, we should take them on their word and say, you know, our ancestors definitely believed that they were not alone. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they were contacted by an extraterrestrial civilization. It just means that they believed they were not alone and that they were contacted by something. But, and I always use the same example because I think it kind of stands out. When you look at Peru, you have pyramids in the north, you have the Nazca lines south of Lima, and then you have this sacred valley, which begins at the Bolivian altiplano of Lake Titicaca. And when you start mapping, you know, Peru is a great country, beautiful civilization. But where are the bits where you truly say, this to me suggests something else going on? Either this Inca civilization is far older, and or something else has been happening here. And these anomalies, you know, even though the Nazca lines have been made famous, as such, it's not really an anomaly. It doesn't require superhuman or non-human intelligence to draw them. The anomalies are in Pumapunku around Lake Titicaca. They are in Cusco. They are in Ollantaytambo. They are in that sacred valley. And so that is the archaeological evidence. And then we have the anthropological or the mythological evidence, which says that a deity appeared, walked down the sacred valley to the Pacific Ocean, and then basically disappeared. Well, the overlap of archaeology anomalies and the fact that folklore explains that those are the precise sites where Viracocha did certain things. Above Ollantaytambo, there is a carving of Viracocha in the mountain, because he is said to look down upon Ollantaytambo. And, you know, all of these things, when they overlap, and it's not just in Peru, but Peru is one example of them. When archaeology and folklore overlap, to me, it definitely suggests that the operating model should be that there were at one point God presence. Now, whether these gods, you know, gave technology to our ancestors or not, I have not seen any clear evidence to suggest that technology, the way we have seen it today, was employed by our ancestors. Instead, I think our ancestors were quite often given information whereby they didn't need the machinery which we need to transport stones. I think we still have a misunderstanding about certain things. And in the book, I go into one example, because what I was trying to show in the book as well is that we have been too focused on a physical contact, and that the other realm can give us information through non-physical means as well. And one of these examples is Terence McKenna, and he was given a mathematical equation which went down into history as time wave zero, this fractal wave of time. Mm-hmm. And the intelligences which gave it to Terence basically said, your understanding of time is wrong. Time is not just some byproduct of gravity. Time is simply, it is. And this is a mathematical equation. And when you begin to understand time, you will begin to understand certain other things. And, you know, to cut the long story short, it is very much on par with the stories of how Imhotep was given by the gods the information as to how to build pyramids. He was given at that moment in time, not necessarily technology, but techniques whereby he was able to build in a manner and on a scale which the Egyptians had not been building before. And so I think when we are talking about technology, we have to understand that the way we're going about it today is, I think, very much what I would call just throw more power in it. You know, if you want to go down, it's wherever you see it. If we want to go faster on the motorway, hey, let's build a bigger engine and let's put, you know, more gas in the car, and that way we will go faster. Nobody seems to come up with this idea. Well, are there other means of creating a new kind of engine whereby we will go even faster? It's simply not in our thinking today to really be radically different in our approach to its problems. And I think this is where we are different from our ancestors. I think our ancestors were far more intimately searching for ideas which are quite mundane in the sense that once you have a basic understanding of the forces of reality, I think you can get away with doing extraordinary things without needing to have these gigantic cranes and various other things which we're using today. Right. So I would say our ancestors had techniques and an understanding of the universe which was different, and you know, not so much technology but more technique.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that that is the kind of rational approach that we need. I like the way that you word that. And, yes, there is a little room for a radical revision of our understanding of these sorts of things, kind of, you know, encapsulating what you were saying there. We're discussing this entire mystery, the ancient alien question, which actually happens to be the title of our guest Philip Coppin's new book. It's a new inquiry into the existence, evidence, and influence of ancient visitors. We're going to continue our conversation with Philip on the other side of this break, and we may even get into some of the ancient construction methods of things such as the Great Pyramids of Egypt. On the other side of this break, I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Grayling Report. We'll be back right after this.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by. Never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Learn more about what we do at WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Continuing our discussion with author Philip Coppins, his new book, The Ancient Alien Question, a new inquiry into the existence, evidence, and influence of ancient visitors. Philip, you know, I wanted to say, during the last segment you were talking about not so much maybe that that our ancient ancestors were literally given materials, tools, or, you know, devices, things along those lines. They may have been given ideas. You know, there may have been almost kind of a sort of mental insemination of ideas and concepts that would allow them to do such things. And you kind of compared that with Terence McKenna, who was, you know, who also claimed that the time wave zero concept was sort of given to him, passed along by some sort of a presence. We know that he was a user of entheogenic substances, and this kind of calls into question the notion of a non-physical contact that these individuals may have kind of had over time. You also talk about in the book the way that the Great Pyramid was built with some type of ancient but also advanced cement, and this is a discovery that was made by one of the leading scientists of our time, Joseph Davidetz. So how does this kind of support the ancient alien theory, and also how does that tie in with the idea of how a potentially non-human or non-terrestrial intelligence might have, even though subtly, influenced humankind and our processes and technological advancement over the years?
Well, first of all, you know, Joseph Davidovich didn't invent cement or an ancient right. type of cement. Basically, what he, as a young child, as a genius, he basically looked at nature and said, those rocks have been formed through natural processes. How did that happen? Is there a way through which I can recreate them, but in a laboratory conditions? So what he creates is basically pure rocks, but in a lab formation, in a lab condition, in a controlled environment, normally speeding up the processes in which rocks are being made. So cement is cement. What he has done is something called geopolymers, basically mixing the bits of the earth together and creating rocks. Now, when he became, you know, he became the father of that science, he has a CV which is longer than most books. He is, you know, respected around the world. But early on, he also became interested in ancient Egypt, and he you realize that not just the Great Pyramid, but even small artifacts which are sitting in museums were done by using this approach. And he basically looked at the Great Pyramid and mapped roughly 40 points whereby he said this is evidence that the blocks of the Great Pyramid have not been quarried beautifully, you know, precisely from the quarries, but basically are geopolymers and have been made on site using various ingredients, some of them indeed stones from the quarries, but you know, which were just thrown in rather than carefully molded into shape. There you know, was various other things, some of them which they had to go into the Sinai Desert for to get things like sodium nitrates and all of these other things. And then everything was brought to the Giza Plateau, and then this chemical process was put in order. And what he, you know, he listed 40 aspects, but one of them, for example, is this. When you look at limestone, limestone is pretty much, and I'm slightly simplifying it here,
sure,
a sandy beach with seashells on, and then over time it becomes stone rather than sand. And so what you have is that the sea has perfectly lined the seashells and everything else in a beautiful line because ebb and you know, the flowing of the water has aligned these things. Anybody who goes to the seaside will see that today as well. Well, when you start looking at the Giza Plateau, you will find that this is not the case. So you will see there that some of them are, you know, aligned this way, others are aligned in a different way. And when you go into the quarry, you will see that they're perfectly aligned there because the quarry at Giza, you know, has been made through natural means. So something has clearly happened, and basically, again, small chunks have been taken from the quarry, were taken to the Giza Plateau nearby, to the side of where the pyramid was constructed. Various other chemicals and various other material was thrown in at them. And basically what happened was that this process of rock creation happened. This is a science which Joseph Davidovich re-identified in the 1970s, and he was absolutely convinced that the ancient Egyptians were aware of this. Now, when he initially confronted the Egyptologists with this conclusion, specifically the likes of Zahi Hawa said, well, we know that the Great Pyramid was not built from cement. And he's absolutely right, except he has completely missed the point as well,
right,
which is that it's not cement, it's a geopolymer. And since then, he... Joseph Davidovich, unfortunately, he is in his 70s, but unfortunately most of his time is currently taken up by taking care of his wife, who's rather ill. So he has not been able to push his material out there as much as he would would like to do so. But his quest has been taken on by the likes of Michael Barsoom and various other professors across the world who actually sent tests into Egyptology departments and said, this is a piece of stone. Could you analyze that? And these labs basically said, oh, this is natural, whereby the likes of Barsoom said, no, it isn't. We made it in our laboratory a month ago. This is not natural. They have also taken material from the Great Pyramid and basically have analyzed that in their own laboratories and came to the conclusion that it was a geopolymer. But the interesting thing is, and what I was hinting at before the break, was that whenever Davidovich went into, okay, so who is the person who did this? Mm-hmm. He basically came across one person, Imhotep, who was the high priest of Heliopolis. He worked for King Zoser. He was the one held responsible for the creation of the pyramid. And he was also identified with creating new techniques of building, which he had been given by the gods. He himself became a hero. He became a demigod because of this way that he had, you know, contact with the gods and had really excelled himself as a human being. And it is interesting that, you know, a science which clearly was in existence in 3000 BC somehow disappeared for several thousands of years and then was reinvented in the 1970s. But the interesting thing is that in this case, Davidovich had no bones. He wasn't an Egyptologist. He just had, you know, invented this science, and he began to identify that he was not the first one. And it, I find it interesting that this is a guy, you know, a beautiful man with no ego whatsoever. But when he comes across the people who have ego, and specifically Zaihawas in this case, you know, it's a battle of ego versus knowledge. And at this moment in time, unfortunately, ego seems to win more quickly than knowledge.
Philip, isn't that always how it goes, though? I see so much of that back and forth between the, you know, the skeptic crowd and the believer. I try and put myself right in the middle, you know, and I take you to be a person who does also. If there are facts that warrant a statement, then that's fine. Show me the facts, and then that's fine. But, you know, so many people, they begin to equate their own kind of, you know, self-imposed belief in their culture and their, you know, their values. And when you see people in the scientific community who really are just dead set on debunking things, I begin to see that they are not so much debunking in terms of or in the name of rationale. They're actually trying to justify their past predispositions. And it becomes a culture thing. It becomes a situation where these people are no more interested in actually obtaining the truth. It's all about egotism and trying to preserve their own image and their standing in the, you know, so-called scientific intelligentsia or the community. You know, you see that so much these days. Doesn't that frustrate you, and do you find it difficult sometimes broaching these subjects because of that?
It frustrates me greatly because the world has this very rosy-colored view of what science is. And I'll give you a few examples. In 2008, I was at a scientific conference on the Bosnian pyramids. There were roughly 25 leading Egyptologists there. The current Minister of Antiquities, Mohammed Ibrahim Ali, was one of the people present there. And we, you know, I was doing a very mundane kind of where is the pyramid debate in this day and age. And I said certain things along the lines of this. The oldest pyramids at this moment in time recognized on planet Earth are the ones in Peru, which have been scientifically dated, there is no controversy about them, to 3,200 BC. None of these 25 leading Egyptologists, some of them who have identified and found pyramids themselves, Nabil Sualem, for example, found four pyramids in his career, were aware of the fact that the Egyptian pyramids were no longer the oldest. And, you know, this was something which had been known for about two years. Uh-huh. Corral in Peru had been discovered before. Of the Roman civilization of Italy, of the 100% of excavations which have happened, only 20% has actually been written up, which means that 80% of excavations which have occurred in Italy, there is no record of. The Great Pyramid in the 1980s, as well as the pyramid next door, was carbon dated. The carbon dating results came back and said that both pyramids were roughly 500 years older, i.e. they are roughly 3000 BC rather than 2500 BC, and that the second pyramid, the slightly smaller one, was actually older than the Great Pyramid one. Traditional Egyptologists say that it's the other way around. For the last 20 years, these results have not been published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, which means that Egyptologists are playing this game that these carbon dating results don't exist. And so whereas they know that their entire chronology is upset and that they should start looking into changing the chronology, they simply play this game whereby the carbon dating results don't get published. There is no controversy surrounding these carbon dating results except the fact that, you know, the chronology is 500 years older. But nobody is contesting the validity of the carbon dating results. Everybody agrees that these results are correct, that there was no contamination or anything like that. So instead, they play this game whereby for a scientist, what you're able to do and just say, well, it wasn't in a peer, it didn't get published in a peer-reviewed journal, so it's not part of anything we have to look at. And it's, you know, it's this warped view of reality. We don't have to look at this because, you know, it didn't get published. And I think slowly mankind is waking up to these things. Climate change debate, I think at this moment in time, is showing that science is not as scientific as it always is. you know, people have this notion specifically in the year like 2012 when there are Republicans trying to identify a contestant for the presidency to run against Obama. It's this idea that somehow you have proper science, which says that there is climate change, and then non-proper science, who seems to somehow be paid by BP, Shell, and various other people and corporations, which denies climate change. And the short answer is that this is a very, you know, simplified problem of climate science. First of all, 2 years ago or 3 years ago now, it was identified that the British Met Office, who has a climate change division, falsified data suggesting that there was climate change. And this came about through some form of WikiLeaks, whereby emails between the various scientists were intercepted. People were fired as a result. The other notion, of course, is that BP doesn't really care about whether or not there is climate change, because they get from various governments across the world a few hundred millions each year. Because basically what companies like BP say is, well, okay, yeah, we might be contributing to global warming, but guess what? The entire economy runs on oil and fuel. So if you want this to be cleaner, we really need funding to do this. So they get government funding to basically look into all of these things. And they're quite happy, with the funding they get from the various governments of the world, because it's a few hundred million, which, you know, for a company like BP is literally a drop, in the ocean.
Sure.
But it shows you that science is far more complex, it's far more diverse, and to some extent than scientists are trying to make it appear. Scientists right now are trying to pretend they're scientific when it comes to the climate change debate. But it is clear, specifically when I think the climate change debate is going to become a bit less political over the next few years, it is going to be more apparent to everybody in the street that really, you have various people with various theories and nobody can really draw a conclusion, rather than this united front which they're trying to pretend. And at the same time, and I think to some extent this is what Ancient Aliens is showing as well, this idea that scientists are basically anti certain subject matter. And I hope that, you know, people and specifically democratic regimes are going to push science into saying it really isn't up to you to decide what you want and do not want to investigate. The greatest crime, I think, which is being committed right now, well, that's maybe an exaggeration, one of the greatest crimes which is being committed right now, is the fact that we let science get away with the possibility that they are not investigating life after death. They have basically said it's not our bailiwick, it's something to do with religion, so we don't touch it. And it's like, well, you know, what does that mean? If all of a sudden I create a religion tomorrow which says cancer is a curse of God, does that mean that everybody in the known universe is going to stop doing cancer research because somehow I have made it part of a religious doctrine?
Good point.
And so, you know, they get away with it because we are not pushing them. And I really hope that there is going to be a push for people to look into this life after death thing. And I think, you know, the reason why we're letting them get away with it is because most of scientists are atheists, which, you know, is a religion of its own, because they believe that there is no such thing as anything after life. Mm-hmm. And basically, the evidence, specifically from an awful lot of doctors in ERs, is coming back that at the moment of death, something interesting is happening, that consciousness does go outside of the body. For all we know, it goes out of the body and dies 5 minutes later. But, you know, something happens, and science is refusing to look into that. And I think, and I hope, that they're not going to get away with that for too much longer.
I agree with you 100%. I'm so glad that you brought up, notions of the scientific, treatment, and also the politicization of things like climate change, global warming, and even life after death, because these are all things that need to be looked at scientifically. But, you know, when you get this kind of intermingling of what scientific approaches should be, and then the politicization, you know, where the money's coming from for research, and you know, who gets that kind of money, and whether it's deemed scientific or something something that's worthy of being researched based on the merit of, you know, economic considerations and things like that. We see that so much with climate change and global warming and, you know, any of these kind of very controversial, you know, subjects that unfortunately, while there may be some scientific basis for them, we see that, you know, this kind of cult of personality or the cult of culture or the cult of egotism for that matter, almost inevitably begins to influence it. And it's just such a shame. I see that a lot also, Phil. With UFOs. UFOs, you know, going all the way back to the Condon Committee, you know, in the 1960s and, you know, just following, Project Blue Book. UFOs were once considered something that were not only of potential scientific merit. Here we had what appeared to be some highly advanced technology right here in our midst. And yet, because it was something that is so inaccessible, maybe not entirely intangible, but something that is indeed considered, you know, so intangible in terms of being able to predict, you know, where a UFO is going to be and how we can observe these things in a controlled circumstance. The general attitude that's espoused by scientists of the day, thanks to the University of Colorado UFO Project, was that, well, we cannot stand to gain from studying UFOs scientifically. We will not further our own scientific knowledge base by studying these. And therefore, since we can't benefit from their study based on the, you know, I think the rather skewed interpretations of a few individuals, this entire notion of UFOs and the scientific merit and the interest in them, whether or not they're any kind of national security, you know, interest or even a threat, that's all dropped entirely. And so these sorts of ideas, again, there is a religion that is, you know, associated very much with atheism or skepticism or any of these things. And it's so sad that people, based on their own determinations, feel that, well, if we can't learn on the terms that we would like to learn from this, then there's absolutely no point in discussing it. You know, and your research also parallels the UFO phenomenon. Do you have similar feelings about UFOs and the treatment that subject gets even today in that regard?
Oh, well, the UFO subject, you know, is so complex. It's clear that something is going on. It's clear that there is some intelligence, behind this. Is this necessarily purely ET in the form that we kind of like, you know, think that this is a visiting spaceship? It might be, but there definitely seems to be more, than that going on. I'm more and more intrigued, and I wish more and more people were investigating it by the old accounts. You know, Jacques Vallée, was one of the few people who really looked into to old accounts. But, I'm actually helping, Duncan Lunan, who was a person who wrote a book called Man in the Stars in the 1970s. And since 1993 has been investigating, an incident in Woolpit, in England, whereby in roughly 1200 AD, green children appeared out of nowhere, spoke a foreign language. The boy died. The girl basically survived, you know, grew up to be an adult woman, and she learned English literally by, you know, pointing, as any person learning a foreign language, kind of like, you know, this is a table, this is a chair, this is a fork, this is a knife. And so once she was able to talk English, she basically said that she came, or that she and her brother, came from a star system, which was different, and that somehow they had ended up here on planet Earth. Interestingly enough, apparently through some kind of, you know, connection or whatever you want to call it, which involved an ancient earthwork. So, you know, Duncan is investigating this further, but this is kind of like where it stands at this moment in time. Mm-hmm. And you obviously have the, you know, Magonia story from the Bishop of Lyon in medieval times, which became the book Passport to Magonia.
Oh, yes.
by Jacques Vallée. And all of these things really suggest that what is going on is again far longer than just 1947. I think when we stick to 1947, we are going to continuously miss points, I think, about what is going on. I think we have had this exposure to a non-human intelligence for far longer, and I think this intelligence has always been here, and, you know, has always interacted with us. And so the kind of like the pun I like to play is like, you know, the ancient alien question asks the question, were we alone? The answer is no, we were not alone. Are we alone? The answer is no, we're not alone. And I think to some extent, the two questions are the same. I think we have never been alone. We have just drawn this distinction. Now, I also think that UFO research is so adamant that they are looking for literally the Holy Grail. They are looking for this object, this artifact, this piece of proof, which is going to prove no matter what skeptics say that E.T. is here. And I think it is, you know, impossible. I interviewed the grandson of Jesse Marcel a few weeks ago for a DVD documentary, which is going to come out this summer. And basically, you know, what you have at the end is a story of a family, a story of a family who has been an eyewitness to this extraordinary event. And there, I mean, to kind of like, you know, lift a piece of there's nothing necessarily, well, there are some new things in the documentary, but it is the way, the family speaks about what happened, which is in my book, the best evidence that something was happening there. And basically what happens is that, you know, Jesse Marcel comes home with this extraordinary bit of material in his car, wakes up his 11-year-old child, gets his wife and his child in the kitchen, begins to unroll it and says, this is what was found by me, you know, and who later turned out to be Sheridan Cavett, and at the Brazil ranch. He shows this, it gets wrapped up. He takes it to Roswell, and, you know, over the next few days, basically a cover-up begins. But it is also clear that the Marcel family and the Blanchards being the guy in charge of Roswell Army Base, they were already family friends before all of this happened. And at one point, after all of this cover-up has happened, what happens is that the Blanchards once again come over to the Marcels, and once again in the kitchen, Blanchard shows Jesse Marcel Sr. this thing which, you know, Marcel had kept away from the people who were removing all of the evidence. And you see these two men saying, you know, this happened. No matter what everybody will say, this is true. And just imagine for a person like Marcel, who's a highly decorated man, who was involved with the atomic bomb explosions, with doing things like Boxcard. All of a sudden, this is a man who is absolutely convinced, who knows that what they have found there is evidence of alien life. And then at some point, Roger Ramey himself or superiors higher up the chain decide that there is not going to be an announcement that E.T. has crash landed in Roswell, that they are going to draw a different conclusion. And he is basically shoved into a camera, into a room with cameras, pushed into a weather balloon, and basically told it is now your job to tell the world that what you found was a weather balloon. He knew that this was a lie. He went on the records, as in the 1970s that it wasn't a weather balloon. But at the same time, you know, he was a military man and was told to say these things. He had a son who was in the military, which basically meant that even if he was going to speak out, it would probably have serious career implications for his son. So what you have at the end of Roswell, to me, at this moment in time, is no evidence. There is no bit of firm evidence to suggest that, you know, anything crash landed in Roswell. But you have a family who, you know, knew for since 1947, you know, more than 60 years now, that something happened, who raised their children with the notion that we are not alone in the universe. A family who, you know, saw things with their own eyes, and are testimony to this other reality. And I think that is, to a large extent, you know, evidence as well. I think that is, to some extent, more compelling evidence than any piece of material or any photograph, because guess what? If ever, you know, the I-beam, as it is so called, which Blanchard brought into Marcel's home in you know, later in 1947, is going to be found out, it is once again going to become the subject of a complete media circus, whereby you will have one side debating this and the other side debating that. Every bit of evidence in any science whatsoever has always been contested by somebody, if only for the simple reason that that person who's going to be skeptical of those findings knows he's going to get his face on camera and a career debunking these things. So there, you know, the quest for the ultimate proof, which still dominates ufology, I think really should be abandoned, and we should really begin to look into more a statistical approach, into more a wider base approach, and basically show that we have, you know, that this UFO phenomena has been around for longer, and that, you know, statistically speaking, amongst these hundreds of thousands of things which are being seen since 1947 and before, by default, some of these things are not explainable away.
I agree. And I think that in terms of the statistics, you know, in addition to looking at our past, something I also advocate is looking at our future, which is a strange concept for many. But then again, if Terrence McKenna was right, and if we should really reconsider exactly what time is, like you said, we may stand to learn some things. We're learning a lot of things tonight because our guest is Philip Coppens. His new book, The Ancient Alien Question, a new inquiry into the existence, evidence, and influence of ancient visitors, is on the table. When we come back from this break, something that has always fascinated me is the subject of Vimanas, ancient flying craft that appeared in the Sanskrit epics. We're going to talk with Philip about that here on the Grayling Report. Stay tuned.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
Finishing up our discussion tonight with Philip Coppens, author of The Ancient Alien Question. I'm so glad he was able to join us tonight on the program. And, of course, before this interview is done, Philip, I want to have you give out your information about where people can find you and learn more about you. And, of course, they see you every episode virtually on Ancient Aliens. You've become quite a popular figure on that program. It would be my sincere delight for you to emerge as the preeminent figure in this field because, you know, it's your kind of rational, methodical approach to this sort of research, I think, that we need to see so much more of, you know. And there's not speculation where it is not warranted. There's speculation where it is necessary, and I'm not someone who thinks that speculative conversation is a bad thing. I always say that if Einstein and people like that hadn't looked up at the heavens and wondered what else might be going on, not just Einstein, Newton, you know, Oppenheimer, any great science mind that you can think of, we wouldn't have the kind of technological innovations that we have of today. But when we think about technological innovations that may have existed in the past, something that has always fascinated me is the discussion of flying craft that may have existed in ancient times. Vimanas, of course, come to mind, and I had recently written about Vimanas myself, and when talking about them, I made a specific mention of a document called the Vimanika Shastra that sort of talked about the technological implications of these craft. And I talked about how, again, there may not be direct evidence that there was a technological basis for these things that the Sanskrit epics seem to discuss. What we do know that the epics discuss are objects that appeared to fly, chariots of the gods, if you will, to borrow von Daniken's famous title. So I'd like to ask your approach, and specifically because, very graciously, one of my listeners of this podcast actually called in, and or didn't call in, they emailed me and they said, you know, I think that you might be off base on some of your views with regard to Vimanas, Mike, and when you have an opportunity to talk with Philip Coppens, maybe he can set you straight. I doubt that we disagree. I would like to hear your thoughts about Vimanas and whether they do indeed represent an ancient technology that was capable of flight.
Well, it's definitely, you know, something which I think is within the bailiwick of the possibilities. My view is this, that there clearly was something flying about at some point in the past. I will first go to the Bible, and basically, you know, Ezekiel is probably the best example of this, mm-hmm. which is a priest who sits in Iraq, Babylonia. He's in exile, and basically gets taken or abducted or flown, whatever word you want to use, to a different place, which some people have identified as Chavín de Huántar in northern Peru. Other people, you know, have different ideas about that. But basically, he is taken by something that flies. Now, when it comes to India, it's not that far from Iraq. And we have this entire tradition which pretty much sits there at the same time. And it sits at a period in time which I think is interesting. And the way I approached Vimanas in this book is once again by trying to layer certain things, by saying what we have in India is potential evidence of an atomic explosion. There's debate. Basically, an atomic patch was found in India, which certain people in India are trying to explain away as being of modern origins, but they have been unable to identify it as such. It's just their speculation, because these people don't work within the framework of the possibility that, you know, these things are thousands of years old. Second of all, Mohenjo-Daro and the neighboring civilization of Harappa.
Yeah.
Basically, what happens there is that people are lying in the streets, holding hands. This was an imminent death. This something struck them, and they died. Literally, you know, people holding hands. This was instantaneous, and this happened on a quite wide scale. So, what was happening here? And guess what? This is a region whereby we have documents like, you know, the ones you were referring to, which speak of clashes of the gods in the sky, mm-hmm. With descriptions of what we would identify as nuclear explosions, or at least explosions of, you know, weaponry, which is impressive, if not gigantic. And within this framework sits Vimanas, of objects which are taken to the sky, which allow people to fly, some of them which are more descriptions of what I would call mass transportation rather than jet pilots, to use some modern terminology. But, you know, clearly, once again, what we have there is a pocket of information whereby it is clear, both from an archaeological point of view and from a legendary point of view, that something interesting was happening, and that their history there is far more interesting than we are currently giving them credit for. Now, you know, I've read some of the skeptics who are saying, well, some of these accounts about Vimanas only date or were written down at the end of the 19th century. Right. It's not really as old. And to some extent, okay, that doesn't necessarily invalidate anything. Several scenarios could happen here. For one, that this was information which for thousands of years was transmitted orally and was finally written down, that it was copied from another source, or indeed, you know, let's just assume that all of this information was written down at the end of the 19th century. Again, this Imhotep, Terence McKenna approach is another means of saying that doesn't invalidate the information. Now, in the case of the Vimanas, I wouldn't kind of, you know, put the Terence McKenna Imhotep stamp immediately on it.
Sure.
But the point is that we shouldn't try to explain it away. Now, do we know the nuts and bolts of Vimanas at this moment in time? Certain people have made reconstructions, just like Blumrich did a reconstruction of the spaceship of Ezekiel, like Imbaun and various other people have done scale models of the gold flyer, this so-called bee-like object in the Bogota Gold Museum. All of these, you know, modern reproductions are helping us into identifying what these objects looked like and what they could potentially be. But at this moment in time, the possibility that Vimanas were, I wouldn't call them spacecraft, but flying machines which were seen in the sky by the ancient Indians, and that these were somehow linked with their deities is the logical conclusion to draw.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that part of what the skepticism involving the Vimana mystery, I think part of that stems from the fact that the specific document, the Vimanika Shastra, was indeed authored sometime around 1920, but it was a document that didn't talk directly about Vimanas. It claimed to explain the technology behind them. It was a channeled manuscript. And looking at this from a very rational, skeptical perspective, I think it's difficult for people to put any kind of, you know, attribute any kind of merit to something like that, and hence they say that that entirely deconstructs the notion that there were technological flying devices in ancient times. The point that should be made, I think, is to draw a distinction between those two things. Set that document aside, but then again, looking at Vimanas in the ancient text, keeping in mind also that Vimana means a number of different things, everything ranging from as a matter of fact, I had a conversation with a Sanskrit expert recently about this who told me that, you know, Vimana means everything from tower to palace. There were certain medicinal herbs and things like that that were used in reference to that term. And then, of course, also flying devices, which appeared in the Mahabharata and many of the Indian epics. I don't discount the possibility that there may have been flying objects, whoever may have been behind that kind of technology. And I don't think it hurts to call it technology. And certainly that the ancient manuscripts, the Vedas, do reference them. But I think that the modern interpretation of, for instance, a mercuric combustion engine and some of these sorts of things do stem from maybe later documents which are somewhat less reputable. But I'm glad to hear your discussion of Vimanas, because to me that kind of works in with the idea of UFOs and what you'd said previously, Philip, that there may have been an ongoing interaction in our ancient past. And if anything, if they weren't some sort of ancient terrestrial kind of technology, if there is a notion of paleo contact and there's merit to that idea, I certainly believe there is, and I think you feel the same, maybe Vimanas fit into that equation somehow also.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, channeled material. I've mentioned Terence McKenna, but currently I'm in Los Angeles, and just outside of San Bernardino is George Van Tassel's Integratron. This was a guy who channeled material, who said that he had encounters with UFOs, and guess what? The Integratron is the result of this, and the Integratron is basically a construction which has certain acoustic qualities. You can go there and take acoustic sound baths. Sound wise, it is clear that Van Tassel was aware of how to play with sound in a way that is uncommon, and was also able to build buildings which incorporated this technology, incorporated his understanding, incorporated his information. And he basically said, I got this from the Space Brothers. Because he was classified as a UFO contactee, people have kind of like poo-hooed this, but the Integratron still stands. It is there. And it is once again evidence of a man who basically said, I did not do this all by myself. I was helped, in this. And, you know, guess what? It works. It people who go there, musicians, people who are interested in acoustics go there and, realize that what is happening there is very interesting. It inspires them. And all of these things once again underline that we have this extraordinary redux of reality, and we try to, classify everything and put everything, into boxes. And then we desperately make sure that they stay within these boxes and never get out. And I think that is a sad thing of our times. I think, we need to push things out of boxes and see how they compare. For example, do things like grail and alien into one word and see what comes out.
Well, that works out pretty well, indeed. But that's the thing, is that I think that people are so married to the concept of, for instance, you know, what our culture deems relevant, especially in the modern era. I had a conversation recently with a very bright, budding scientist, and my purpose for contacting this individual had to do with a very interesting concept of our future, or maybe not our future. It may be far closer than many realize, but the idea of a technological singularity or a intelligence explosion. You know, Jacques Vallée touched on the idea of technology reaching a point where the rate of growth of technology would become almost indistinguishable according to human perception. And he, you know, put that time frame at around 2026. Ray Kurzweil and some of the transhumanists of the day put it around 2029, 2030. This is not very far off. And if indeed this happens, I'm fascinated about how the idea of greater than human intelligence, which is what singularity is supposed to entail, and artificial intelligence and the like, how that may relate to UFOs. I'm working on a book proposal right now that deals with that subject. And when I spoke to this young scientist, she said to me that although she's interested in singularity, she wouldn't discuss UFOs with me and wouldn't engage in any kind of speculative discussion whatsoever because of the fruitful merit of the other more plausible scientific endeavors that are already available before us. And to place a limitation on thought like that, to me, Phil, puts such a, you know, such a damper on our ability to progress as a species. The greatest minds had to be speculative, I think. And I don't think that there is, you know, any shame to warranted careful speculation in terms of understanding our sciences, whether that be looking at the past or looking at the future or just what we have right here before us today. Clearly there's evidence of something. And I think that your work does such a fantastic job tying together some of those loose ends and things. And real quick, before I have to let you go, I think the clock's about to catch us, but you know, this October we're going to be hosting the Paradigm Symposium in Minneapolis, and you're going to be one of our speakers there. I can't wait to have you on board. Will you have other book projects and things coming out in the time between now and then?
Absolutely. I just got an ebook which is called Killing Kennedy, which is actually a book I wrote 20 years ago.
Oh, wow.
But which is now coming out as an ebook. I will be working on, as I said, a number of DVDs. There's a DVD component to The Ancient Alien Question, which is coming out in the next few weeks, if not months. A few DVDs whereby it's something along the lines of Philip Coppens Investigates. So kind of like the Roswell is one, and there will be a few more. And I'm also going to write a successor to The Ancient Alien Question, which is going to be called The Lost Civilization Enigma, which basically, you know, whereas The Ancient Alien Question asks, were we alone? The Lost Civilization Question is basically going to ask the question, were we the first? So it's moving into similar, yet not exactly similar material there. And then, yes, definitely, I'm very much looking forward to an extraordinarily great lineup in Minneapolis in October. And, you know, sometimes you just have to look at a poster and you kind of like realize it's going to be a great event. And the poster which you guys released over the weekend just shows that this is indeed a great event, and it's going to be a great event.
We're very excited. George Norrie has just confirmed, and I've been talking with Tom Danheiser, producer of Coast to Coast AM, about this on the telephone very frequently. You know, our schedules are kind of funny, and he's West Coast time, I'm East Coast time, and of course, you know, they're all vampires at Coast to Coast because they do a late night broadcast. So, you know, I've been keeping some rather strange hours myself, and talking with the fantastic people there at Premier Network. We are so excited to have George and so many others, and of course, the mighty Philip Coppens on board for Paradigm Symposium 2012. It's going to be a night to remember, folks. You'll want to check that out. Philip, also your website so that people can follow up on your research and more about what you do.
Absolutely. Well, the website is philipcoppens.com, which is PHILIPCOPPENS. If you type my name into, for example, Facebook or Twitter, you will also come to my page. But if you want to go directly, it is facebook.com/coppensphilip. It's turned around. And on Twitter, it's twitter.com/philipcoppens.
And that finishes our conversation with Philip Coppens for this evening's edition of the Grailian Report. When we come back in the next hour, we'll be taking your phone calls live here on the program, in addition to weird news, anomalistics, and exopolitics from beyond the fringes of insanity and insight. It is the Grailian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Who knows, maybe we'll continue a little bit of this idea of the discussion of ancient civilizations, lost civilizations. Maybe we'll go all future. Who knows, what's on your mind? We'll come back with more of that here on The Grailian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Stay tuned.
Hey guys, Jamie Havoc in here for UFO Mag. Do you want to receive the best writing there is in ufology, the best writers, editors, and flat out the best magazine that ufology can offer? If so, I highly recommend UFO Magazine. You can check it out at ufomag.com. And if you mention that you heard this on the radio, you can get 6 issues for $19.95. Check it out, ufomag.com. Don't miss out. And keep up to date on the hottest topics in ufology. For UFO Mag, this is Jamie Havkin.
Ranger Station.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting in the forest.
Uh-huh.
1 second I'm having a smoke. Next thing I know, I'm face-to-face with Smokey Bear.
Wow.
And he told me it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
Did you know 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans?
I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous and you're not. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
This is the sound of a flat-screen television hurled off a building. Now the new bike your kid wants. These are the things you could have, all cast into oblivion. Because when you throw away money on wasted electricity, you throw away everything you could have bought with it. Use Energy Star light bulbs and appliances, and you could save hundreds of dollars a year. Saving energy saves you money. Learn more at EnergySavers.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Ad Council.
Politics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Gremium Report with your host, Mike Evans.
Wrapping up this week's edition of the program, welcome back. It is the Gremium Report. I'm Micah Hanks. How about Phil Collins? Phil Collins. Whoops. Wrong guy.
I knew that was coming at some point.
Yes, we had the drummer slash lead singer from Genesis right here on the Gremium Report.
I'm struggling tonight with this lip thing, man. Don't ever use the self-sealing envelopes, you know, that like have the little sticky strip or something that you peel the thing off. Don't ever lick an envelope ever again.
Why don't you just get with it and send email?
Because you can't pay bills with emails,
you
brother.
You can pay bills online, though, partner.
Some bills, yes, that's true. And I pay all that I can. But, yeah, so I've cut my lip and everything, and it's Phil Collins. Philip Coppins is what we meant to say. Anyway, Philip Coppins joined us on the program during Hour 2 there, discussing his new book, The Ancient Alien Question, a fascinating discussion of what might have been long, long ago. And that said, we're glad to be back on the program here. Chris, let's see here. I think we've got a couple of stories. We've got this Death Mountain thing here, and then we also got an explosive, well, this really bizarre story, actually, about the North Star potentially fading out. Is that do I understand this correctly?
Shrinking
the North Star shrinking. Exactly what is this supposed to entail?
It's the scientists think it may be shedding layers.
The North Star. How does something like the North Star shed layers?
Magic.
Why don't you go into detail about that for us, Chris?
Well, it looks like basically. Over analysis of the past 160 years, the North Star has been losing mass, you know, a very tiny, super tiny amount of mass. And it may be because the North Star is going into a helium burn phase, which I don't really know that much about, but that's what I'm told by scientists.
Okay, I see. Interesting. Well, we'll have to continue following that. We'll bring that story up. I think Science Magazine NorthStarMag.com actually has information about how the North Star may literally be wasting away. We'll come back and we'll discuss that again a little bit later. Also, this story of an explosive volcano that may lurk beneath Death Valley. That was just from the end of January here. Can you believe January's already almost gone? Very interesting. But first, before we get to all that, maybe we'll touch on some listener emails. Dale writes, Micah, just some food for thought, something I hadn't really considered, and perhaps it's old news to you already. Well, let's find out. Of all the thousands of taxpayer-funded and commercial satellites in orbit providing real-time weather, real-time flight status, and myriad other resources at a simple keystroke, why isn't there a single satellite feed available of real-time photographic views of the planet? Now, in 1997, the Russians had twice as many satellites as we did, just under 1,400 in orbit, and as broke as they were, still no access to real-time satellite imagery. The closest I've been able to find is a feed from the U.S. Geological Survey that plays back images 24 hours old. In this day and age, I know the technology is there, so why no access? Is there something maybe that they don't want us to see? Ciao, Dale T. writes. Thanks, Dale, for that very much. Who knows, maybe there is something going on. And of course, immediately, I'm sure that people think Google satellites, you know? Something like that. Maybe you know, we can still see the world with Google satellites, but not in real time. Is it just too much of a danger when we begin to incorporate real-time satellite monitoring of you know, ground areas around the world? Is this something that, you know, of course, could be utilized by terrorists, or would it actually present fewer dangers and risks by virtue of kind of opening up the airwaves or the internet? I guess probably would be the likely medium for which this kind of monitoring would be made available, and thus allow people to kind of, you know, think about it like this, okay? In your neighborhoods, you know, we see these signs that say neighborhood watch. So if you come in here and try and screw around in this neighborhood, people are going to have their eye on you, so don't do it. Don't come in here with you know, bad intentions. People are going to be keeping an eye on strangers who come around this neighborhood. Well, could it be the case that as opposed to being something that terrorists could potentially hack into and utilize for negative reasons, could satellite watch systems that literally monitored the world in real time, could that actually allow the citizenry and people around the globe to monitor situations around the world and then report suspicious behavior, just like you might do on the web or just like you might do in something like a neighborhood watch program? I don't know. It's just a thought. All I'm saying, I'm not trying to make a case for it. I'm saying that maybe there would be good as well as the bad. And I think that the bad is far more obvious in this digital age where we have organizations like Anonymous and which aren't really organizations. It's kind of like a loosely knit, I don't know, what would you even call Anonymous? I guess they're an organization, but, you know, again, you don't know the names of those involved. We don't know. I think that number kind of changes from day to day and from event to event. Sometimes the things that they're involved in are very good and obviously of merit, and I think at other times that there's, you know, a outright dangerous potential to some of the involvement of an organization like Anonymous. So, you know, there's always good with the bad when the web's involved. But that's interesting, too, the notion of satellite technology and how it might, who knows, eventually allow real-time monitoring via the web of everything around the world. Would that help or would it hinder?
I feel like whatever good could come from having, you know, live, up-to-date streaming satellite images is still going to be outweighed by the possibility for bad, because it's just the possibility is so much greater and you have so much more opportunity to use it negatively than you do positively.
There are obviously a lot of dangers associated. You know, I mean, that cannot be denied. There are a lot of potential dangers associated with any such system that would allow the public access to literally watching anything anywhere in the world that they want to. And granted, we're not talking about zooming in on a new, you know, beach and watching, you know, the little hotties and the honeys, you know, somewhere, you know, halfway across the world.
Why not?
Well, I'm not saying that. Well, you know, that's the thing. Yes, be forewarned. If you decide to sunbathe in the nude in a European country, well, and for all I know, this may already be something that, you know, Google Maps and things like that utilizes. But, you know, real-time satellite monitoring, yes, indeed, this would, of course, make that all the much easier. So you've got e-voyeurism, that's a consideration. You've also got e-terrorism, which is a consideration. But then you've got e-neighborhood watch, which is something that could, again, I don't know if that would offset all the obvious negatives that would be associated with such a thing. But anyway, This explosive volcano beneath Death Valley, this is interesting. California's Death Valley, already one of the hottest places on Earth, may have the potential to get a whole lot hotter and even live up to its name in a surprising and possibly scary new way, according to some recent research. Scientists have long known that the craters that pepper this dry landscape were formed by long-ago volcanic eruptions triggered when hot magma ascending from inside the planet hit pockets of water. Now, some researchers think that this area erupted far more recently than previously thought, meaning that the parched swath of central California, home to desolate salt flats and scalding temperatures, could be primed for a follow-up of sorts. Dates for the geological catastrophe are fuzzy, but researchers used to think that the Death Valley's largest crater, a half-mile-wide gash in the earth nearly 800 feet deep, formed around 4000 BC. Yet new evidence uncovered by a team of scientists at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory suggests that the dramatic crater called Ubehi last erupted only 800 years ago. Although that may sound like ancient history, in geological time, 800 years is a mere blip, and because the crater formed relatively recently, it might still be restive, and plenty of liquid hot magma still could be lurking beneath it. Now, the cataclysmic explosion that formed the crater was likely a terrifying spectacle, according to the study's authors, whose work is published in the current issue of the journal Geophysical Research Letters. When the hot magma hit groundwater, the interaction likely produced a powerful explosion that smashed a hole through the overlying rock, sending out a scalding hot mushroom cloud of deadly gases that raced across the ground at 200 miles per hour. Wow, that's incredible. It would be fun to witness, but I'd want to be at least 10 miles away, said study co-author Brent Goering in a statement from the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. The evidence comes from chemical signatures trapped in small fragments of rocks the team gathered near Ubehi. Dating techniques and analysis revealed that the rocks were birthed by eruptions that happened once every 1,000 years or so, and that the most recent large eruption occurred around the year 1300. Interesting. And there's no basis for thinking that Ubehi is done, according to Christy Blick, who is also Nicholas Christie Blake, a Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory professor. However, there's a good chance that the crater could provide plenty of warning ahead of any deadly fireworks along the lines that were seen more than 1,000 years ago. The awakening volcano could set off small earthquakes in the region and even open steam vents as early as a year before an eruption, the scientists have also noted. And, you know, with the amount of volcanic eruptions and other kind of geological travesties that occur, the danger associated with that region anyway. You keep hearing these reports. Here it is, 2012, and people are talking about the end of the world. And there are some people out there who I think are genuinely concerned that we actually may have, something along the lines of California breaking off the West Coast and, falling into the ocean. I don't think it's really going to happen, you know. I think it's anecdotal at best, but you do hear people talking about that sort of thing. Now, why would that happen? Who knows? But let's just hope that in addition to the earthquakes that already ravaged the West Coast, we aren't also going to be soon dealing with something along the lines of a large hot magma vestige, some sort of a area where literally, they're talking about 200 mile per hour magma bursts flowing from the ground. This could be dangerous indeed. Let's hope that's not going to be the case. When we come back, we'll be discussing this and more on the Graylian Report. Stay tuned.
Hey guys, Jamie Havoc in here for UFO Mag. Do you want to receive the best writing there is in ufology, the best writers, editors, and flat out the best magazine that ufology can offer? If so, I highly recommend UFO Magazine. You can check it out at ufomag.com. And if you mention that you heard this on radio, you can get 6 issues for $19.95. Check it out, ufomag.com. Don't miss out. And keep up to date on the hottest topics in ufology. For UFO Mag, this is Jamie Havkin.
It takes 12 years to create a graduate. It takes about the same time to create a dropout. And at the end of the day, the difference between a child becoming one or the other could be you. So United Way is asking you to make a pledge. Tutor a child who needs help. Mentor a kid who needs someone on their side. Volunteer to read to children. Because when a child advances, we all advance.
Be a reader, tutor, or mentor. Give, advocate, volunteer. Live United. Take the pledge now at liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
For your light in the darkness. That's right, for the Graylian gang, keeping you company every Tuesday from 8 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. It is the Graylian Report. Welcome back to the program. We were talking during the last segment. I think I misspoke. Every time I misspeak, I want to be clear about that. Josh, I think you pointed something out during the last break there that I'd mentioned magma racing along the ground, but actually it's magma only when it's underground, correct?
Yes. It's magma when it's underground and lava when it's above ground. And in the case of Death Valley, the flow would be pyroclastic, and that's where you're getting all the... gases and stuff from.
Excellent. I stand corrected, friends. That's why we have people who are men of science on hand. That's always helpful. Indeed. but anyway, you know, we've been talking about EVP a lot lately, and I do want to direct people's attention over to an article at mysteriousuniverse.com called Voices from the Shadows, The Voice Phenomenon of Parapsychology. This deals a little bit with EVP, and yes, it was written by yours truly. There's always good stuff over at Mysterious Universe. They've actually got a very fantastic podcast, which I'm sure all the listeners, every one of them who listens to this program, is already well aware of. But you'll also see, you know, Jason Offutt's been doing some writing for Mysterious Universe for the last little bit. That's always good. Close Encounters of the Giant Kind is the latest offering from Nick Redfern there at Mysterious Universe. And, of course, you'll always see updates from yours truly. I've also got an article about Mothman, some of the misconceptions associated with the Mothman mythos.
Maslin Othman,
yes, indeed. You remember that whole fiasco, which was interesting. You know, I mean, here's this woman who was allegedly going to be, and I say allegedly because a lot of that, you know, is usually the case when this sort of thing goes to the media. You know, these sorts of stories, when they deal with something sensational like the idea of extraterrestrial life and UFOs and things like that, they tend to end up being a complex mixture of truths and half-truths. But there is a woman whose name is Madeline Othman, who is allegedly going to be, I think as the story went, kind of given the jurisdiction of some sort of alien...
Ambassador of liaison. The universe.
Yes, some sort of
liaison.
Yes, exactly. And so here she ends up in this position where she's kind of... given the chief, you know, if aliens land, you're going to be the person who talks to them. And here, yes, her initials, M. Othman, you know, that's pretty wild.
I think, you know, if you think about it, and we're talking about going through space, and for us to do it, we want to do it as post-singularians, singularitarians.
Singularitarians, yes, indeed.
So we're biologic, but mostly non-biologic. Wouldn't it make more sense to have Stephen Hawking be the ambassador of space, because his voice would be, you know, more calming to the non-biologic entities that would be visiting us?
Well, you know, if I were a non-biological entity that were traveling through space, I don't know that I would find Stephen Hawking particularly comforting. And the sad reason for that is because, again, you know, we reported on the program recently, Stephen is not, he is not someone who is capable of speaking and communicating quite as clearly as he once did. Hawking, You know, I think right now the state of his ability to communicate is down to about one word per minute is what they'd said. We talked about this on a previous edition of the program. And if you're a new listener, you know, you should check that out because we've discussed this in the past. Unless there's some sort of a rapid, increase in the kind of technology that would help rehabilitate Stephen Hawking, and I don't know that with his condition that's going to be possible, to be honest. Unless there's that, or there's some kind of a very new technology that literally allows him some greater ability to communicate. You know, it's not looking good for Stephen. You know, it very well may be a case where in the near future he will be virtually unable to communicate, which is such a travesty because you can tell that his mind is still sharp enough to remain functional. Stephen Hawking, you know, he's still able to think probably as clearly, you know, and as quickly as he ever did, but he's not capable of communicating those thoughts. And that's just, it's sad to see this. But, you know, he's lived a lot longer than people actually estimated that he would. A lot of, folks thought that he probably only had a couple of decades, and I think he's actually lived a lot longer than that already since being diagnosed first with his debilitating disorder that has left him in his present state. Stephen Hawking, though, interesting fella, and if indeed he were capable of communicating, I think he would be a fantastic liaison to extraterrestrials elsewhere in the universe. Poor guy. But something we touched on earlier this hour, speaking of extraterrestrials, we were talking about the North Star, a celestial beacon to navigators for literally centuries now, maybe slowly shrinking according to a new analysis of more than 160 years of observations. The data suggests that the familiar fixture in the northern sky is shedding an Earth's mass worth of gas each year. Got a bad case of gas, sounds like to me.
Well, I mean, in perspective, that's really not that much.
Well, maybe putting things in perspective. I know it's more gas than I shed on a yearly basis.
Are you sure about that?
Well, you know, yeah, that's subject to question. That said, however, the data suggests that the familiar fixture, again, is shedding an Earth's worth of mass each year, and that some researchers caution, however, that the conclusion that some are making depends on certain assumptions about exactly where the star is in its several billion year life cycle. Now, also known as Polaris, the North Star always sits over the North Pole because it is aligned with Earth's axis. Find it in the night sky, at the end of the Little Dipper's handle, and you don't need a compass to orient yourself. To weigh Polaris, astrophysicist Hilding Nielsen of the University of Bonn in Germany and colleagues essentially took its pulse. The star grows dimmer and brighter over a roughly 4-day cycle, and the team studied variation in the length of that cycle. Like all stars, Polaris is made of gas and layers around a core where nuclear fusion occurs. As its gravity pulls the outermost gas inward, then Polaris kind of develops a layer, which is referred to as an opaque layer, just under the surface, that doesn't let light through very easily. It causes a dimming of the glow. And then the light builds up beneath this layer and pushes on it like water vapor boiling up under the lid of a saucepan. And that light heats the opaque layer, causing it to expand and then making it more transparent again. The star becomes bigger and brighter until those outer layers of gas fall inward again and the cycle begins anew. Now, even that 4-day pulsation isn't constant. Back as far as 1844, it was about 12 minutes slower than it is now. Previously, astronomer David Turner of St. Mary's University in Halifax, Canada, who was not involved in the new analysis, and his colleagues compiled an archive including historical measurements of that pulse. Their data set ended in 2004. Now, Nielsen and his collaborators, including two citizen astronomers, have now added their own observations from the past decade. This long record from 1844 to the present shows that the pulse of Polaris runs about 4.5 seconds slower each and every year, which, again, of course, if that continues to trend downward, may be indicative of a lessening radiance that the North Star emits on a yearly basis. The changing rate suggests that the structure of the star is evolving. Well, that's a nice way to put it, huh? Even if a shining star loses its luster, you're not going dim, you're just evolving. Because if things didn't change, we wouldn't have any butterflies, right? Everybody knows that.
Wow, you really changed.
You really changed, but anyway, well, so that's what they're saying, is that the North Star... But you know what would we do if we didn't have the North Star? Now, we're not saying that it's going away altogether. It's just that it may not be, well, as bright as it once was. But I would argue it's probably still going to maintain its position as being the biggest, brightest object in the, you know, celestial object in the sky, except for when UFOs happen to be present, right? When we have UFOs present, that all changes indeed. But Who knows? Hopefully people, travelers, those who are sojourners in the night will still manage to be able to gaze up into the sky, and if they're ever lost and disoriented, they'll be able to find their way quite easily by use of Polaris, the North Star. You know, Polaris, I believe, was also the name of a character. All right. In the X-Men comics. You remember? She had green hair. She was always a favorite of mine. Maybe I've just
she was Magneto's daughter.
That's right. Maybe I just got a thing for chicks with green hair. Who knows? Oh, Graylian Green. That's right. It is the Graylian Report. We'll be back right after this.
The 9/11 memorial is for the 343 firefighters who didn't make it.
For my husband who died that day.
And the first responders who saved my life.
Because the best of humanity can overcome the worst hate.
This is Robert De Niro. This year, as we open the 9/11 memorial in New York City, we ask that you join us to honor, remember, and reunite. To learn more or to reserve your visit, go to 911memorial.org.
Brought to you by the 9/11 Memorial and the Ad Council.
It's the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
Welcome back to the program. You know, I tell you, I've been struggling lately trying to find weird news. This week just seems like one of those weird weeks where there's just not quite as much weird news, but there was definitely one or two really good stories. This one certainly caught my eye. Newsoftheweird.com, actually Chris found this one, about a ghost appearing just before the demolition of a house. And there's a photograph that accompanies this. We'll include this in the show notes for tonight's program. This is pretty interesting, I have to say. I'm always interested in spirit photography, EVP. You know, Chris and I were involved in an EVP session recently that I actually want to try and get a little bit more involved sometime soon. I want to broaden that concept at some point. Getting back to this story here about the ghost appearing just before the home demolition. What we have is David Grimshaw, who says that this person in the image, and it definitely looks like, you know, kind of the slightly, I don't know, maybe ethereal visage of a woman standing there. David claims that this is Frances Grimshaw, his mother, silhouetted in the window just before the house she worked in and adored was demolished. The woman standing in the window isn't actually standing there. In fact, no one was even in the house at the time that the picture was allegedly taken, but what clearly appears to be a woman standing in front of the window looking out, maybe even with her hand raised to her face, can be seen in the photograph. This photograph was snapped by Robert Johnson, the demolition supervisor on the job that day, who was getting ready to demolish the house pictured, and only moments after this photo was taken. Looks like someone wanted to give the building a final goodbye. According to the Daily Telegraph, the image is said to bear an eerie resemblance to Frances Grimshaw, who worked at the guest house and stood for hours at the same window taking bookings. David Grimshaw, a former resident of the property, said that he was convinced the figure is indeed the ghost of his mother, who died nearly a year ago at age 87. He believes her spirit may have appeared to protest at the demolition of Meadowbank House, which she adored. "That is my mother," David said. "I'm totally convinced. No one else looks like that. She had glasses and big earrings, and she used to wear a dress with a bow at the front," he said. "She used to stand in that room for hours on the phone. It was the guest house reception, and she took bookings from right in that room. And indeed, you see a woman." And the funny thing is that I guess that this is what they're saying. It looks to me kind of like maybe she's got her hand up by the side of her head or something like that. And it's a little difficult to discern anything. You know, in fact, we might just have to say that there's indeed just something on the window and that it has conveniently created the impression. Because I have to say, you can see moisture and condensation running down the sides of the window as well. And so it very well could be that this is just a trick of light, something like that. But it at very least, you know, whether it's pareidolia or whatever else, you know, we look like we're seeing a woman standing there with her hand up to her head. Maybe she was making one final phone call from beyond the grave. And that's a subject that we do hear about from time to time. People actually talk about phone calls from the dead. You know, and we've got this Ghosts, Spirits, and Hauntings, Am I Being Haunted, from the Exposed, Uncovered, and Declassified series that New Page put out earlier this year. And I talked about in my essay in that installment of the trifecta of, and I have to say that, you know, they're really good. I mean, the other authors that are in these things are incredible talents and resources in this field, not just in ghosts and hauntings, but in a variety of different areas. But in my specific article, I did talk about a woman who claimed that she actually received a phone call from her dead grandmother. She was a very talented young model in a particular part of Europe. I actually don't give a lot of the specific details for purposes of protecting the family. It was very difficult for them because, in addition to the grandmother passing away, the young girl who'd gotten the telephone call subsequently died from a bacterial infection. But she claimed, indeed, that she'd gotten a telephone call from none other than Grandma right there on the, on the house telephone. And furthermore, that this not only was something that she experienced, but that the housemaid was standing right behind her when this happened and had actually managed to overhear the conversation and attested to the fact that, yes, it sounded like the deceased grandmother that had called and made this phone call. Isn't that incredible? Maybe a little disturbing, even? I know that disturbs me. I wouldn't want to get a phone call from a dead person. What about you guys? Anybody here willing to take a phone call from the other side?
Yes, let's.
I didn't say we were getting a phone call.
I know, but I want to, so yeah. Let's do that.
Yes, if we can get a
any ghosts that want to call.
Any ghosts.
As long as it's not my grandmother. She doesn't approve of anything that I've done. I just don't want that phone call.
We're waiting. We're waiting.
Now's the time.
We're even holding hands to set the mood in here.
Yes, we're having a veritable seance here in Graylian International Studios. That's right. Stop that, Chris. Chris! Just kidding. Oh, well, no ghost phone calls tonight.
You made me weep silently into the microphone.
We weren't really holding hands, don't worry. People were genuinely concerned. I felt the impression off of the listenership. They were crying inside.
Why are you so afraid of our love, Micah?
I'll tell you something else I'm a little scared of. Inexplicata, the journalist, Hispanic Ufology this week, talking about a UFO wave ongoing in the western corridor of Argentina. This was just as recent as yesterday that this was posted. Argentina, UFO wave ongoing, according to, I guess, Scott Corrales and the others there at the Journal of Hispanic Ufology. Initially unnoticed, there's a new photograph depicting four luminous dots in the skies over Moreno, which prompted action once again by researchers of the UFO phenomenon in the area, involving the repeated manifestations of unidentified flying objects of unknown origin in the so-called Western Corridor, where residents from a variety of locations in the outlying districts have reported and recorded said manifestations. Now, Fabian Torti, director of the Grupo Técnico de Astienza Psychologia, OVNI, GRUTOP, okay, we're talking a different language here, but I think many of you would be familiar with the OVNI acronym, they told Dario Popular that for over 7 months since the public became a fixture, or the subject became a fixture after a series of cases in the area, that phenomena had been repeated and had been repeating themselves with sightings of mysterious flying objects, these luminous globes and all different kinds of things, in the area. And the individual reporting said his group in no way definitively classified them as extraterrestrial presences. They didn't know what they were, but something was indeed going on. In this regard, Torti noted that the phenomenon also brought about a massive influx of eyewitness accounts and stories involving sightings and unique events related to these manifestations. Everything ranging from the disappearance of animals to abductions, subjects that GRUTOP places under scrutiny given the application of psychological criteria with which to study such cases. And that's something that I wonder about often, too, especially with regard to a lot of these reports in different parts of the world, especially you see these in South America. and things like that. Culturally, in a number of these areas, and this was kind of outlined by Jacques Vallée in his book Confrontations, we began to see that there are a lot of different cultural interpretations of UFOs as understood within these cultures. For instance, one of the indigenous regional names in parts of South America for various different kinds of ghost lights that would appear that were taken to be UFOs was actually chupas. They would be called chupas. And chupa because they were believed to be life or soul suckers that would literally steal the life of those who came nearby. There were many instances where these objects, glowing lights that would come along, would actually beam lights at individuals that would sometimes leave a scar or sometimes harm them otherwise, and in a few instances, some of these individuals were even killed in the presence of these objects, these chupas, as they were called. Now, as is common in that part of the world, men would climb up into trees and they would kind of lay in hammocks throughout the evening while they were hunting for deer. And they would lie in this hammock and they would wait for a deer to come along, and then they would, of course, this is kind of like the American equivalent, you know, of a tree stand. Well, anyway, these circumstances would often occur where these men would be in these hammocks hanging high up in a tree waiting for deer to come along while hunting by night, and then a strange inexplicable light would come soaring in over them, kind of disturbing. And then these lights, if they seemed to be able to spot one of these men, one of these individuals, they would beam a little pinhole-sized beam of light down that would sometimes cause scarring or sometimes cause tissue damage and other different kinds of things. And on a couple of instances, yes, some of the men who claimed to have been accosted or previously accosted by these things, one man was found to be incredibly disoriented. It said that he viewed one of these lights and then a few hours later was found dead. They weren't certain if he had died from shock or some other kind of influence on part of that craft. It was a strange circumstance. Jacques Vallée outlined this series of cases in his book Confrontations. Who knows what was really going on? But again, many of the people in that locale felt that whatever these things were, variously described as being an object maybe about the size of a standard refrigerator. Now, sometimes they're described as just large globes of bright light. But these objects would appear and that they would attack people. And they believed that they might actually be sucking the very life or the soul out of individuals, and hence they were called chupas. Now that expression chupa, that prefix, of course, is far more popular in terms of cryptozoological lingo. Those who are familiar with chupa know it to mean chupacabra, or the goat sucker, as they are called. But those are a different kind of sucking animal. And there's altogether this parallel that really comes back to vampirism, that there are supernatural entities that might come about at various times and literally suck the life out of an object or a person or an animal, suck the very life's essence out of individuals and cause them harm. So what is it about various aspects of the paranormal and the notion that these creatures or these entities, these intelligences, are trying to steal something from us? You know, we could take it a step further. Think about Nigel Kerner, who was on the program recently, talking about the harvesting of the human soul, and that there's some aspect of alien abduction that may actually involve the literal harvesting of souls from individuals. Then we also have these notions of the classical interpretations of the incubus and the succubus, where individuals are literally taken and of course they're maybe treated to a erotic encounter with a spirit that appears to resemble the epitome of the gender, but nonetheless which seems to also have the strange and startling ability to draw some sort of life's essence or energy from the individual that they are engaging in the deed with. So, you know, there's this long-standing tradition in the unexplained of interactions with individuals that seem to be robbing humans of some sort of presence, you know, chupas or incubi or succubi, vampires even. The vampire is probably the most classic archetypal example, you know, the notion of a vampire, a sometimes winged creature that exists by night and that will come and will bite and suck the blood of its victims. This is something that is quite prevalent in a number of cultures and dates back thousands of years. But again, what is it? Where does this stem from? And why is it almost an archetypal substruct within cultures? Why is it that there is this notion? Maybe it stems entirely from the fear of just of dying, the fear of death, the fear of something coming and taking us or taking from us things that are important, things that, of course, that matter, and what matters more than our ability to live, our freedom, our life. All these things on that kind of level seem to be kind of interrelated, an awful lot of parallels. And even UFOs in that sense can kind of fit into this category of strange soul-sucking that goes on from time to time. You know, again, I've been making frequent mention of a project I've been working on recently and everything, and that's something I've begun to look at a little bit more seriously, is the actual idea of, if not soul harvesting or soul sucking, as we describe here, maybe the idea that some intelligence, some non-human intelligence, some metaphysical presence, and again, I take this kind of in the context of ufology, but looking beyond the old biological alien visitors from another planet and thinking, well, maybe what if there were some sort of a interdimensional presence that could interact with us in a strange or uncanny way? And what if indeed there could be something about that presence that would allow them the literal ability to either harvest or manipulate or drain, you know, life's essence from an individual? Many people who, and what got me thinking about this is, many people who describe their abduction experiences feel that there is something not particularly friendly about these experiences that they're having, and that it seems to involve, you know, based at least on abductee reports, the harvesting of something. Now, in many instances, it is very physical, that what is being harvested is maybe sperm and ova for purposes of genetic manipulation and genetic breeding, or, you know, people being used as a sort of, I think the expression intergalactic breeding stock comes to mind from time to time. Whatever the case may actually be, these instances are of interest to me because, again, what is it about this act of taking something away, you know? And if in some instances, it's even the individuals that are taken, you know, and the act of abducting is literally taking a person from their home. You know, again, it's this infringement. If you look back at reports, early reports, and especially Native American legends pertaining to creatures like Sasquatches, we often hear stories that involve these creatures doing, guess what? They kidnap a woman and they also utilize them for breeding stock. You know, there are even these stories of women, you know, in Native women being, you know, married by Sasquatches, I guess, at least in a very primitive sense, you know, taken back to the Sasquatch den and made to live there and have little Sasquatch babies. This is something that's prevalent, you know, in these cultures, and I don't think that's something that should be entirely ignored, because what we're dealing with is something that is obviously, well, very close to us, capable of engaging in sexual activity with us on various different levels, and something that many people feel is attempting to rob us of something, take something from us, take something away from us. Maybe it's our souls that they want. Who knows? Yeah. Maybe I'm just being crazy. But anyway, that says, well, who knows? That could go in any different direction. That almost wraps it up for this evening. Bill writes in to say, Pol-la-rus, with the accent on the middle syllable. My bad, as usual. I guess I'll have to save it for next week when my lip's feeling a little bit better. For that, we're going to wrap it up for one evening. I'm Micah Hankson, on behalf of all those associated with the program, including our guest science advisor, Josh Buckner, for sitting in this evening. Thank you very much, Josh, for joining us tonight on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely, as always. And, of course, on behalf of John Anderson, the voice of the mountains, Dick Oakley, producer Chris Hayes, engineer Matt Oakley, all of you out there in Radio Land, of course, Holly, even Stephen Accounting, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South, this is the Grailian Report. We bid you adieu, my friends, and as always, keep us up to date on what's happening in your neck of the woods. You can send us an email, info@grailianreport.com, to tell us more about what may be happening where you are. We always love to talk about that here on the program. And until the meantime, my friends, stay strange.